straight. I'm just a mean green mother from outer space, and I'm gay. I'm just a mean green mother from outer space, and it looks like you've been had. I'm just a mean green mother from outer space, so get off my back, get off my face, cause I'm mean and green, and I am gay. Oh, yeah, I'm bad.
Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
This week on the show, we're taking a trip on down to Sean's beta corner to check out BioWare's Anthem. Smash Bros. Ultimate and Dragon Ball FighterZ both have new DLC, and the DC Universe movies may finally be getting their shit together? All of that and more on this week's show, but let's start as we usually do. How's it going, Sean?
It's going pretty good, I would say.
It's Super Bowl Sunday. We're recording, it was just halftime. I haven't been watching the game. My roommate's watching it upstairs, so if you hear people shouting, that means someone is doing something, I guess.
Yeah, likewise for my dad is currently watching the Super Bowl game, so yes, if someone is shouting on my side of the courting, something also is probably happening.
Are they rooting for anyone in particular? I hope you're not going to say the Pats.
I have no fucking idea. Okay. I don't know. I don't follow football ever, but particularly right now, it's like I do not have time to pay attention to that shit.
I just want the Patriots to lose. That's all. I hope we don't lose any listeners over that. But the Patriots are bad. They're dickheads. And I don't really know anything about them other than that they're dickheads. And I don't know why people like them. So that's like my two cents, but I know nothing about football. So,
you know, we live in a world where lots of people like dickheads. And I don't understand it, but it seems to be where we're at.
Sadly, that is a good assessment of the world as it is. But yes, we're going to be doing some news today. We're going to be doing some video game reviews. Not really reviews, but I mean, we're talking about DLC. We're talking about demos. We're not like reviewing anything new, because, you know, Anthem is not out yet, technically. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk more about Destiny 2 Forsaken, which you've been playing. And now I've played a ton of as well. I've beaten the campaign on that. Played a bunch of Gambit and some other modes in that DLC. So we have a lot to talk about there. Yeah, we are not talking about Lord of the Rings this week. We'll get to that at some point. We know you're waiting for that. We're going to be doing our retrospective, looking back on... We're starting with Fellowship of the Ring. Sean, you're too busy to watch it as well.
Yeah, I just don't have a lot of time to watch it right now. I did take the step of I pulled out my extended editions and have them next to my PlayStation now. So it's okay. Like, when the time comes, I'm like, fuck it, I can blow 3 hours. I don't know when that time comes. But when that time comes, I can very smoothly transition into watching the movie. So I'm there. I'm at that stage.
Well, I was going to offer, Sean, if you're too busy, I could mail you DVDs of the theatrical cuts. I have extra copies. Those are shorter. You'd save at least a half an hour. And on Return of the King, you'd save over an hour. So
we might have to consider that when we get to Return of the King. We will see. By the time we get to Return of the King, it'll be like fucking spring break or something. So maybe that will work out.
On the extended cuts, they're on two discs. You could just split them up. Do 90
minutes
here.
I don't like it. I don't like watching movies that way. I like the one sitting, even if it's the fucking 3-hour monster. I gotta power through it.
All right. Well, we'll get to that someday, but we're done making commitments on that because it's too hard to predict. Y'all voted for the longest movies.
Exactly. So. If the fuckers had voted for Zatoichi, we would be like 4 movies deep into that right now because those movies are like 90 minutes a pop. I could do that whenever.
This would be the weekly Zatoichi podcast.
Exactly. It's the thing I've been working towards on this podcast for literally years at this point.
We would be podcasting blindfolded just to be in complete, you know, in unison with the character Zatoichi.
I mean, honestly, I don't think it would affect the podcast much if we did it with our eyes closed. But yeah.
I'd have to prepare the outline in Braille. And I'd have to learn Braille.
You just memorize the outline. Just sit there repeating the outline to you over and over again until you have it memorized.
Well, speaking of the outline, Sean, it tells me that the next thing we do is stuff. My only piece of stuff is that I beat Dragon Quest IV this week, and then I beat it again. Because the way this game works is you beat it, and then I think they added this in the PlayStation remake, which is what the DS version and the iOS versions are based on. They added a 6th chapter, which is, it's interesting. It basically takes you back to, like, up near the end of the game, but now there are extra options, and you can sort of see an alternate ending where things work out a little better for our characters, but you have to work for it. and you have to do like a new dungeon and stuff. It's pretty cool, and like the little alternate ending they give you is very nice, and you get to, like, the little spoiler is just you get to play with the villain of the game, turns out to be not that bad, and you get to have him on your team, and that's pretty cool. And overall, Dragon Quest IV is just an amazing game. I don't know what else I have to say about Dragon Quest at this point other than, you know, four games deep now for me, I've just gone 1, 2, 3, 4 without stopping, is they're just so fucking relaxing. To just sit back and run a dungeon in Dragon Quest is just the nicest thing in the world, because you got fun Toriyama monsters, and you've got this really nice battle system to use, and you got that fun music, and you can do it while watching TV or something. And then you've also, you know, got a great story and characters on the side. It's just such a great series. I love it so much.
Yeah. I'm really anxious to get back to that at some point. Yeah, and because Dragon Quest IV was one of the ones that I remember when I was kind of reading ahead when I was first playing them, being like, I really want to get to that game.
Yeah.
Someday I'll get there.
It's got less... It's still... We're in the period... Because this is still one of the Famicom games.
Yeah.
Five is the first Super Famicom game. And I think a lot of people would point to Five as being sort of like that series' Final Fantasy II, the IV moment, where, like, the narrative really maybe takes center stage. So, like, there's not as much in 4 as you might want if it were the same kind of story in a modern setting.
Right.
But there's a lot of really interesting turns to it. You know, those games are pitched at a certain tone where they can do a lot with very little, actually, in terms of the writing. You know, sometimes it is so fairy tale and folkloric that they can be pretty minimalistic with the storytelling and get a lot across. But it's a really cool series, and I have not started 5 yet because I just wound up playing a lot of Destiny this weekend. Mm-hmm. But I really want to play 5. It looks so good, and I'm like, I'm this deep. I can't stop now. I can't. That'd be madness.
Yep.
Or playing endless JRPGs is madness. I'm not sure. What have you been up to, Sean?
I mean, generally my stuff is the stuff we'll be discussing in the video game section. I dove back into Dragon Ball FighterZ a bit because Videl and Jiren came out. Obviously been playing Destiny 2 Forsaken a lot. Like, that's been my main thing because it is very convenient to be able to play that game for like an hour to 2 hours each night. And they just have set up the weekly challenges and the daily challenges so well in that game to make it so that it's just like something I can come back to every night and make a little bit of progress on my character and put it away and feel good about it. The other thing I've been doing is just like grading a lot of writing from 11th graders. And Jonathan, I think we maybe have to give up on the apostrophe. I think the apostrophe's done. I don't think it's going to survive the coming generation because holy fucking shit.
It'll survive in one place I know, and that's in the word it's, where they will always, no matter what, spell it IT apostrophe S, and I can tell them the difference and they don't give a fuck. It is IT apostrophe S in all scenarios.
Yes, you're 100% right. It is every other scenario in which you use the apostrophe will never be used. And then the apostrophe will only be put in it's when it's the wrong it's.
Yes.
When it's the contraction it's, they'll be like, nah, we don't need the apostrophe. When it's possessive it's, they're like, let's throw that fucking apostrophe in there. You're like, motherfucker, I thought the apostrophe key was broken on your goddamn computer. Now I find out, no, it's just, yeah, the it's really bad. The contraction situation is rough because I just think I have to blame texting at some point. That's got to be what it is. That nobody bothers to put a
texting corrects it. Texting does it for you. That's what's weird.
But
they don't have to know it. Okay.
Yeah, they don't have to know it. And so when they write it by hand, they don't really do it. And then especially Google Docs does not correct it, generally speaking. Especially for some of them, like won't. If you don't, like won't and want, or W-O-N-T, want, not a very common word, but it is a word in the English language. And so a word processing software is not going to fucking catch that for you. And yeah, I've had to give this spiel a lot over the past week or so. Because it's a rough situation out there on Grammar Street, Jonathan.
That sounds like the worst Blaxploitation soundtrack ever. I'm thinking of Across 110th Street for those who are thinking, but Across Grammar Street. That's like, yeah. Sesame Street does a Blaxploitation movie. I have a suggestion for you, Sean.
Yeah.
We had a high school teacher who we both loved who always gave us Latin roots quizzes on Mondays and made us memorize all the Latin roots. And I think you should do that just with contractions and apostrophes, and just every week just give them a fucking list and they have to write them out correctly or identify them or something.
The problem is, when you do a Latin and Greek roots and affixes quiz and like that setup, that's because the students don't know what those affixes and roots mean. They all understand how to use the apostrophe. They all understand that if you write can't, there's a fucking apostrophe that goes between N and T. They're 16 to 17 years old, Jonathan. They're not complete morons. They know that much. They just don't give enough of a shit to fucking put it in there. So
I mean,
no extent of quizzes will ever solve this problem. You have to somehow fix, like, teenage apathy. And that's a challenge that I am not fucking up to.
No one's up to that, Sean. It's the natural state of being. Neither of us have played Kingdom Hearts 3, I should say. Unless you have a surprise for me.
Fucking no. We will definitely cover Lord of the Rings before I get around to picking up Kingdom Hearts 3.
But my brother, who, again, he was there like day one with Kingdom Hearts as like a 7-year-old, you know, so he loves this series. He's played it. I've talked to him about it. He beat it in like 2 days. He played it very fast. I'm going to share a quick text exchange we had because I think it's kind of funny. So it started, he told me, "Hey, I beat Kingdom Hearts 3. And I said, "Nice. Was it everything you wanted and more?" And he says, "Of course not. It's fantastic, but it has some issues. And actually, all of them stem from it being too short." And I said, "Interesting. Does it resolve the series well?" "Haha, no. The after-credits scenes tease at least 2 more games."
Fuck.
So I've talked to him about this, and just to like summarize his thoughts on the series, or on the game being too short thing, he thought there were like, there's a lot of great moments in it. It does a lot of, like, good character building, but there's a lot that he, like, was invested in other characters in the series. And not just, like, the obscure characters in, like, the spinoffs, like Kairi, one of the main characters in the game.
Yeah, she's in 1. I have seen stuff with Kairi, because I've seen the beginning of Kingdom Hearts 1.
Apparently Kairi is barely in this game, and that was upsetting, because they've been hinting, I guess, for, like, 3 spinoff games now that Kairi was also going to become a Keyblade Master, and in the opening movie of the game, which you can find on YouTube, Kairi's got her own Keyblade, and I guess she's barely in the game, and he found that disappointing. They should have made more room for Kairi. He had some other, like, he mentioned some other things about the plot, and a character who I still don't fully understand the origin of, but I think it's, like, there's a character who, so Roxas is Sora's nobody, and he's the good dude at the beginning of Kingdom Hearts 2, and there's a character who is Roxas's vision of Kairi, but it's not Kairi, it's like the equivalent of Kairi in Roxas's world, and I guess she's a cool character, and she wasn't in the game enough either, but to be frank, I don't understand that whole relationship there, because I can't tell you what a nobody is.
I think the villain in the game makes clones of people that whose names are anagrams of the person with an X put
I know that.
Yeah.
But anyway, we're getting off track here. So, there were some things that they could have done more. He thought, like, the ending is fairly satisfying for, like, the story up to now, but it also isn't, like, he said it's in no way the end of the series. Like, it is very clearly, like, a launch pad for more stories. He says there's, like, multiple games teased after the credits that, like, the ending is not, like, you know, and Sora went and lived happily ever after or anything like that. So I was curious about that. I've asked him, like, because I'm curious, like, what the future of Kingdom Hearts 3 is now, of Kingdom Hearts is now, assuming this game sold well and they're going to do more. There's no more handheld platforms for them to go do them on, you know? So yeah. I guess they could do another browser game, or they're going to have to actually do console games now. And I'm very curious, because that's kind of bold to be like, we're finally doing Kingdom Hearts 3, we're going to end the series, but no, wait, here's some spin-off teases for you. But also, like, that sounds so right to me. Like, that's Kingdom Hearts has to do that. Like, Kingdom Hearts can never just end. That wouldn't be Kingdom Hearts, right?
Yeah, because that is one of those things that I was curious about, because I feel like they, you know, as someone who has not played Kingdom Hearts, the only thing of Kingdom Hearts I know about is, like, the first hour to 2 hours of Kingdom Hearts 1. Basically, the beginning of that game to them getting to the town that has the really good song that plays when you're in the town. That's as much first-hand experience you have with Kingdom Hearts, and that was watching one of my friends play it on the PS2. That was not even me playing it. So I don't know anything about Kingdom Hearts. But my impression was that everybody felt like Kingdom Hearts 3 had to be, like, kind of the end of Kingdom Hearts, not because that's what Nomura and Square Enix said, but just because it's been so fucking long that it's like, yes. Well, it has to be. Because why would they not have just put out Kingdom Hearts 3 at this point and spent all the time with spinoffs if, like, Kingdom Hearts 3 isn't the end of it? But I don't feel like they ever explicitly set up that expectation. And so it is this weird, it's this really weird feeling of where it's like, we've been waiting for Kingdom Hearts 3 for so long, kind of feeling like, well, that has to be basically the end of it. And then it coming out and realizing, well, no, there's absolutely, they never said that. Why do we all think that? Like, this is not the fucking end of it. Kingdom Hearts 4 could come out in 2 years. It could come out in 20 years. It could come out in 100 years. I don't know, but Kingdom Hearts is not fucking done.
Yeah, I mean, what they said, and apparently this is, like, accurate to what the game is it's the end of the Dark Master Xehanort saga, is what this says in, like, the description of the game, which, by that, they just mean the saga we've been telling in every game up till now. So, yeah. You know, it's like the end of the original Star Wars trilogy, if the original Star Wars trilogy had 50 spin-offs between Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, but they weren't completely done yet, so who knows. But yeah, Kingdom Hearts, it fascinates me, it looks like a cool game. Thomas said, you know, he said the best part of the game might have been the frozen world, and he described a scene to me that I really want to play the game for, which is they have apparently the entire Let It Go song mm-hmm. in there, sung by Idina Menzel. It's like the song from the game, it's the animation from the, or song from the movie, animation from the movie, with Donald, Goofy, and Sora running around in the background, like, trying to follow her, and I just can't believe, like, Kingdom Hearts is such an enigma to me because it got, like, licensed at a time when Disney was in a weird rut, and now Disney is on top of the fucking world, and this is not what current corporate Disney would ever do in a million years. But, like, Kingdom Hearts is, like, grandfathered in. It's so bizarre.
Yeah, like, because I saw some of that cutscene where the Let It Go thing, and, yeah, it is, like, I only saw the very beginning of it, but it looked like it was like, basically, here we remade that scene in the movie, but every once in a while you just cut away, as you described, to Sora, Donald, and Goofy just standing off to the side, and like, is that Elsa? Guys, we gotta go help her! And then it cuts back, it's like, what's going on? And she's just singing Let It Go, and it's like, oh my, is she building a palace? Oh, that's it. It just keeps on cutting away in the middle of, like, I kind of wish they had just used the footage from the fucking movie and just, like, cut between it, because that would have made it even better.
It's great. I think they should do that for more scenes. Like, they should do a Lion King world where, like, you know, Simba is, like, next to dying Mufasa, and, like, they're running around in the background like, hey, is that lion dead?
And it's like, oh, no, is Mufasa okay? And it's then like, guys, we need to help Simba, come on!
And then we meet Mufasa's nobody, Afuxma.
Yes.
Or something.
Good job.
All right.
That's a top-tier Kingdom Hearts joke.
All right. So let's go ahead and move on and talk about the news. We're going to start with some movie news. We're going to move over to some video game news. And actually, I have one thing I just want to mention that's not on the outline, Sean.
Okay.
Which is that last week on our 2019 Year in Preview, which was a really fun episode, and you should listen to it if you didn't.
Yeah.
But anyway, we talked about, one of the movies we covered was the new Fast and Furious movie, Hobbs and Shaw. Did you see the trailer for that? It looks so good. The opening is Idris Elba explaining how he's a superhero now because he has bulletproof skin. And then someone says, who are you? And he says, I'm the bad guy. And I'm like, they know what they're doing. This movie, like, and throughout that trailer, this movie feels like it knows its tone better than just about any movie has ever known its tone. And I am so fucking there for it. I can't wait.
Like, watching that trailer made it feel like these games are set, like, or the games, these movies are set 20 years in the future. Like, it's just like, as someone who hasn't watched any of these movies, I saw the beginning of that trailer, I was like, did I load the wrong trailer? Like, what is this fucking, like, Call of Duty Advanced Warfare bullshit that's going on right now with Idris Elba? And then it cuts to The Rock. It's like, okay, nope, this is 100%, like, fuck it, okay. Yeah, sure, why not?
It's like, this movie is so beautifully self-aware, at least from that trailer. And then there's that scene at the end where The Rock is, like, running across a skyscraper, shooting people, and it's really cool. And Jason Statham's in an elevator. I'm just like, this movie looks great. I can't wait. I don't know why I ever doubted this. They still should have called it Calvin and Hobbes. That would have been great. But this looks awesome.
I mean, honestly, the one part of the trailer that didn't sell me on wanting to see the movie is I feel like The Rock handily outclassed Jason Statham in that trailer. Like, every scene with Jason Statham was like, eh, this looks okay. And every scene with The Rock, and I'm like, yeah, fucking, this looks like a fun movie.
The Rock handily outclasses most people.
It's true.
Yeah.
But yeah, it just feels like the tone of that trailer was way more Dwayne The Rock Johnson's speed than it was Jason Statham's, and it just felt weird. As someone knowing nothing about their characters, having seen none of these movies, that is my only impression from watching the trailer.
I just think it's funny because, like, literally two movies ago, Jason Statham is the guy who, like, murdered several of their friends and was the guy they were trying to get revenge on, and now he's their buddy, or at least he's The Rock's buddy. So it's great. You know,
The Rock's only been around for a couple of movies, so he can have been friends with those guys for very long.
He's been in half the movies.
Oh, God, it has, because he was in the fifth one, was the first one. Yeah, I guess it has been that long, huh?
He's 5, 6, 7, 8. He's not in 7 that much, but he's in 7.
Okay.
He fights Jason Statham in that movie, yeah. 8 was not that good. This looks better, so I'm excited for this. It looks like a nice revitalization. And, Fast and Furious, you know, it's going to keep on trucking. So let's go ahead and move on to our DC news. We start with the big news of the week, which is that Matt Reeves, the director of the Planet of the Apes movies, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and War for the Planet of the Apes, and many other things, his Batman movie is confirmed to be an actual thing this week. It was a report in Variety, like studio sourced, not, you know, like a leak or anything. It's going to be called The Batman, is what they've been thinking about. So I don't know if that'll actually make it to theaters as The Batman, because I get why people want it to be called that. It's kind of a goofy title, but we'll see. It's coming July 2021, which is pretty far off, and this was our first official confirmation. Ben Affleck is not involved. Reeves has a total blank slate. He will be casting a younger actor. They're just underway with the casting process, so we will be hearing about that soon. You know, this has a lot of implications, obviously, because this is now DC basically coming out and admitting, like, other than Wonder Woman and Aquaman, they're done. Like, all of that's gone. Mm-hmm. They're starting over. We're gonna have a new Batman. There's, like, no links to that. And also Ben Affleck's out. And the best headline for this was the AV Club, whose headline was, Ben Affleck finally achieves lifelong dream of not having to play Batman anymore.
Yep.
So, yes. I mean, what do you think, Sean? Are you happy for Ben Affleck? He finally gets to go home and stop being Batman?
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy for him. It was probably a hard-fought battle to not be fucking Batman anymore. And yeah, it does just feel like, this is the final bullet. This is, like, the end of that era, you know. They're still making... They're going to make... You know, Wonder Woman 2 is in production. That's going to be out. They'll probably make an Aquaman 2, because that movie made a shit ton of money.
It made more than all of the other ones. So, yes, there will be an Aquaman 2, 3, 4, and 5, I assume.
Yeah. But I'm guessing that those movies are going to be behind an iron curtain. Like, all these different movies, it feels like they're making... are all going to be totally separate, have fucking nothing to do with each other, and it just kind of feels like WB has given up on the Cinematic Universe project, which is probably wise, because they fucked it the fuck up. It's sort of like, yeah, fuck it. We were totally fine just making Batman movies before this, and we will be totally fine making fucking Batman movies after this, and we don't need to do any of the complicated shit of sharing the toy box with all these other directors and characters and stuff.
Well, because if you want the real, like we said, like, nail in the coffin, bullet in the head, whatever you want to say, like, the other part of this report is they confirmed that James Gunn departed from Marvel because he was fired because weird, crazy right-wingers dug up old tweets. James Gunn is going to be writing and directing the next Suicide Squad movie, which is dated for 2020, but it will be unrelated to the first film. It will have a new cast, it will be either different characters or the same characters recast, but he also basically has a blank slate. That's come out in the last week. We also know there's this Birds of Prey movie coming out, which I want to talk about in a bit, because it actually sounds pretty cool, and that is Margot Robbie as Harley Quinn, but otherwise completely unrelated to these films. We know that Joker movie coming out has no relation to these other movies. This Shazam movie, it does not seem like they're trying to, like, push that really hard. You know, theoretically, the Flash movie with Ezra Miller is still in the works, but we have not heard anything about it in, like, a year, and it underwent, like, 4 different writer-director changes and all of that. So I think they're just done. I think they're trying to put Justice League behind them, and, you know, Henry Cavill has said he's out, so we're never seeing that Superman again, thank God. We're never seeing Ben Affleck's Batman again, thank God. You know, we are seeing more of Jason Momoa and Gal Gadot, and that's awesome, because they're great. But I don't think their movies are going to have any more connections to each other, which is probably for the best. The best suggestion I saw on Twitter was that, like, we know Steve Trevor, the Chris Pine character, is in the next Wonder Woman, because he's in that image they put out from the movie. And they said the way they do that is just Diana realizes she, like, went to sleep and woke up in an alternate universe, and Steve Trevor's not alive, or not dead in this one. And that's how she knows, like, all of that other stuff didn't happen, is we just put Wonder Woman in a different Earth. And that's how Steve Trevor is alive, and that's how, like, Batman doesn't exist. And I thought that was funny. But they really don't need to do that, because no one remembers those other movies. You know, mm-hmm. I saw Justice League, you saw Justice League. What happened in Justice League, Sean?
Steppenwolf was in it. What the fuck did happen at the... I literally don't remember what happens at the end of that movie, other than the Justice League wins, but the specifics, it's gone.
I think they, like, hit the doodad with the thing, and it blows up.
Yeah, there's probably a boom tube, which I only know because I've read the comic books.
It's
fucking... I feel like it's very bittersweet in a number of ways. That you know, it was goofing about the terrible WB... DC stuff, movie stuff on this podcast has been one of the great ongoing joys of this podcast for what's like almost 5 years at this fucking point. Like,
it's... Batman v Superman was announced in 2013, so yes, it has been.
Yeah, so it's been a long journey, and I've gotten a lot of joy out of making fun of the terrible fucking decisions they've made. I managed to avoid watching Suicide Squad, and that's great. And so if Suicide Squad 2 is good, I don't have to see the first one since it's unrelated. And so, you know, there's a push and pull in terms of my feel. I have a lot of mix of feelings here. One other thing that is kind of a bummer, though, is thinking about the potential of being able to have a DC cinematic universe that is good, and WB just fucking that up so much that idea can't work, because it would have been really fun to see a different take on what Marvel is doing done competently with another set of characters that I have a lot of fondness for. And so not being able to have a cool, like, world's finest style Batman Superman movie team up, it fucking sucks. But they're so bad at it, and they proved themselves so bad at it, that this is clearly the right choice to make, is to wall everything off again, like, make that hot comic book superhero movie money while it is still that, like, genre is still, you know, in the zeitgeist, but don't try to play with the really complicated stuff of making it its own universe and just have each movie be its own, is the right choice, even if it's kind of a bummer that they couldn't get their shit together.
Yeah, I mean, it is sad knowing that the Earth has been salted well and good for at least a few decades, I'm assuming, for having a Justice League movie or a Batman v Superman movie or anything like that, or as you say, a world's finest movie is what we would actually want. You know, that Earth is just salted. You know, if you want it, go to the CW. They have all their superhero shows. It's not the A-listers of Batman and Superman. Although, the Flash is an A-lister. Fuck it, you know. He can get he's an A-lister. But, you know, Supergirl is, as I've said before, probably the best live-action Superman adaptation I've ever seen. It's just, it's Supergirl, not Superman. So there you go. And Superman is in it, so you can have fun with that. And their crossovers are super fun and goofy, and they're what you would want out of an actual Justice League movie, just with a lower budget. So, you know, I feel like we're probably getting a best of both worlds approach here. You know, the thing is, now we're in a space where they've... Because this is not just conjecture, by the way. I forget his name, but the producer who is nominally in charge of the DC stuff has said in interviews that they are trying to transition away from the shared universe thing and trying to focus more on, like, filmmaker-driven films, like standalone projects. So, like, that is clearly what they are trying to do. And now that we're in that space, I'm excited for a lot of these projects. That's what's interesting, is that, like, yeah, we've been able to make fun of their fucking up a lot, but now they have a bunch of stuff either in production or soon to be in production that sounds interesting. Like, Matt Reeves is a really good writer. He's a really good director. He didn't really come to prominence in, like, the zeitgeist until the Planet of the Apes movies, but, you know, he was one of the guys, like, I think he directed a lot of the early J.J. Abrams shows. He made the first Cloverfield film, which, not a great movie, I think it's directed very well, though. He did that remake of Let the Right One In that probably does not get enough credit for an impossible job done well. Mm-hmm. you know, I think he's a really interesting filmmaker, and I think an interesting choice for Batman. And now that we know, like, he gets to do his own thing, it's like, phew, okay, he doesn't have handcuffs on. That's good. You know, this, I wanted to share about this Birds of Prey movie, because it sounds really cool. It's Margot Robbie playing Harley Quinn. It's an actress named Journey Smollett-Bell playing Black Canary. Mary Elizabeth Winstead as Huntress. Rosie Perez as Detective Renee Montoya. Ewan McGregor as Black Mask. Chris Messina as Victor Zsasz. Those are all characters I would be happy to see on screen. It's directed by a new filmmaker named Kathy Yan, who has done some really promising short films and independent films. It's written by a woman named Christina Hodson, who did Bumblebee, which I thought was fantastic, a really good Transformers movie, and it's really well scripted. Like, that's one of the big things that differentiates it from the other Transformers movies. And that sounds cool. It's a genuine, like, woman-led effort to do a female or to do a superhero film with, you know, women top to bottom producing, casting, directing, writing. That's really interesting to me and feels like a good, you know, like mea culpa for all the just rampant sexism in the Zack Snyderverse and in the first Suicide Squad. James Gunn doing a Suicide Squad movie, that will never not make me sad, because I want him to be doing Guardians of the Galaxy, and I am sad that Marvel's maybe best franchise has been neutered, and that sucks. But he's a talented guy. You know, all of these sound more interesting to me, and if this is the kind of thing they're doing, as I've said before, Wonder Woman's good. I liked Aquaman. Slowly but surely, you know, Shazam looks like, at worst, it will be fine. You know, like, so, so this is progress. This is progress, yeah. Guys. You know, that's nice. It's nice that, like, as you say, we're maybe losing our laughing stock, but, you know, we'll always have the memories.
Yeah, we can always go back and watch that one Batman v Superman trailer that shows Doomsday in it, and it'll have a good laugh.
Yes. I mean, final thoughts on Ben Affleck as Batman, as we will probably never talk about that again.
You know, we could put him in the box with Val Kilmer and George Clooney, and he can be there with the movie Batman's That Time Will Forget. Because, you know, like, hey, he did his own thing with it, and I appreciate that. He was a very different version of Batman. He killed people. He was an asshole. He was generally unlikable. Every moment he was on screen, and it kind of felt like, for most of the time, he just didn't want to be there. And that's a different kind of Batman, and so that's nice.
I'll say, in Batman v Superman, I will never be one of those people who says, you know, if only it had been a good movie, he was a brilliant Batman. I don't think that. I think in Batman v Superman, though, he did some interesting stuff. I think he was better than the material. I think we could agree. He's probably...
Yes.
Yeah. You know, I think he has some moments, particularly as Bruce Wayne, that I really liked, because that... Every Batman since Michael Keaton... That tends to be where they've struggled more, and I thought he was good at that. I could buy that a guy who looks like Ben Affleck and has that kind of affect about him could be this, like, reclusive, crazy billionaire who goes out and fights crime, and I thought he leveraged that in some interesting moments. In Justice League, he clearly just wanted to slit his wrists. He did not want to be there. It's Jennifer Lawrence in X-Men Apocalypse levels of, please get me out of this movie, for God's sake. And, you know, now he's free. There's also the moment that no one ever talks about where in Suicide Squad he has his cameo where he rips Harley Quinn out of the water and then just starts, like, molesting her and kissing her furiously. And I've heard the explanation, oh, he's giving her mouth to mouth, but that's not what it looks like. It's played as he's sexually assaulting Harley Quinn, and no one talks about that. But that happened. I assume Ben Affleck didn't have that idea, so we don't have to blame him for it. I don't even know if it was him there on the day, because he's in the Batman costume, so that very well might not be him in that movie. It could just be his voice. But yeah, you know, it was not a good Batman. It's definitely the worst Batman in terms of its totality. I don't know if it's the worst Batman in terms of performance, because you don't get much more misaligned than George Clooney as Batman.
Yeah, no, because, yeah, it's definitely, he's the most, and not, this is not Ben Affleck's fault, because this is the shit that he was given, but this version of Batman is by far the least pleasant, or the most unpleasant version of Batman put to screen.
Yes.
Like, it's, yeah, I will be very happy going the rest of my life never watching Batman v Superman or Justice League again.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we can forget about that. You know, this also all means, Sean, we will probably never have to see Jesse Eisenberg as Lex Luthor again.
Oh, fuck. Thank fucking God.
That's the exciting part.
Yeah, so that could have been, man, can you imagine if we had gotten, like, a Justice League 2 or another Superman movie with him as the villain again? Oh, yeah. Jesus. We dodged it. Man, remember how they never made a fucking sequel to Man of Steel?
Yep.
Remember how they didn't do that? What the fuck, dude?
I mean, here's the question. Do you think they do Superman again in the near future, like the next 10 years? Or do you think they're done with Superman? Because they just have... They've literally... Other than Superman 1, they've never figured it out.
Mm-hmm.
He is the least well-serviced major superhero on screen by a country mile.
Yeah, I think they're going to stay away from him for a while. Like, it's going to be, I think, probably 10 years is, like, the minimum you need to go before you try Superman again. Because it's just... I think he is a hard character to do, but they've also just, like, given him to the wrong people repeatedly at this point. Because there are great Superman movies to be made. Zack Snyder is the last person on Earth to be making them.
Right. And he's definitely out.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's got to be someone out there who has a great idea for a Superman movie and could really make it work. I have to believe that person exists. And I wish WB would at some point try to find them. Because
I mean, they fucking Marvel has knocked it out of the park with Captain America. If you can do Captain America, you can do Superman. There's no reason why you cannot do a good Superman movie.
Oh no, Marvel has done much harder characters. It's just, I mean, and part of it is they are bound by Superman has a longer history on screen in the public consciousness than any of these characters. That was the problem with Bryan Singer's Superman Returns, which we can never watch again. Just that twofer of Bryan Singer and Kevin Spacey, that goes in the trash bin.
Oh, geez, yeah, I didn't even think about that side of it.
Yeah, not fun anymore. But that aside, you know, that was so bound by, like, we're doing the Christopher Reeve Superman again, and that's why that movie is boring. And then Man of Steel was like, we're going to do Batman, but we're going to call him Superman, and that didn't work. And so, I don't know. We'll see. I wonder if they're going to do that. I wonder if this Flash movie is ever actually going to happen. Probably not.
I don't think so.
But we'll see. That's movie news. You want to move on?
Yeah, let's talk about video game news, Jonathan.
All right. Nintendo, you were asking last week, like, hey, what of Nintendo's iPhone or phone games, you know, mobile games? Because we were kind of like, oh, it'd been a while. Well, we got a little update on that. Mario Kart Tour was supposed to come out fiscal year 2018. It got delayed out of that. They're saying this summer now, so summer 2019. They also announced Dr. Mario World for iPhones this summer. And I have to say, Dr. Mario World is the best idea they've had for an iPhone game yet, because that actually sounds like something I would want to play on my iPhone. That sounds like a pretty natural fit. You put Dr. Mario on an iPhone. So yes, they are doing something with these iPhone games. It still feels like that is not Nintendo's priority. I mean, if they could get this pushed out of fiscal year 2018, clearly, like, the calls from shareholders about mobile games have stopped is what we can probably surmise out of this.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's where they're going with mobile stuff.
Yeah, neither of those two seem like they'd be easy to turn into gotcha, you know, money factories. Maybe you could with Mario Kart. I don't know how many different... You could get a bunch of different, like, vaccines or something from Dr. Mario World, but I don't think you... Those are different kinds of phone games, and so that's nice that they're not just taking their properties and shitting out gacha games to make $500 million a year, which is a very easy path that Nintendo could go down if they wanted to.
Yes, they could do the Konami thing of becoming a pachinko game company.
Yeah.
But they haven't done that yet. All right. Speaking of, this is sort of related to Nintendo, the possibly last major original 3DS title, Persona Q2, New Cinema Labyrinth, finally has a confirmed release date for the West. It is coming out June 4th, so this summer. That's a perfect time for that game, by the way, because my semester will be just done, and I'll have some time, and I can play this fucking JRPG. I'm excited. It's got a rad special edition coming out that has a plush Koromaru. You know, I wish it, like, had a soundtrack or something, but I've pirated that shit already. I don't need it.
I have the soundtrack.
It's really good. Yeah, but I would take the plush Koromaru. That looks... It's like a 5-inch... I want that. I totally want that. That looks awesome. How did we not have a plush Koromaru before? The most interesting thing about this announcement, though, is that it's not going to be dubbed. There will be no English dub for the game. It's just going to be subtitles with the Japanese language track. Apparently, an Atlas USA representative said something to the effect of the game maybe underperformed in Japan. And so They just did not have the localization budget to do it. This is the first Persona game to come out without that, that has been voiced, to not come out with a dub. It's definitely a little disappointing because the dubs are very good. This would have been the first time all three casts would have been together. They've been doing the dubs. The dancing games had them just a couple months ago. So it's a little disappointing. I'm just happy we're getting the game. The Japanese casts are great, and I'm totally fine with that. You know, I don't feel ripped off or anything. I think more than anything, it speaks to the 3DS. And actually, given this and another piece of news, I might revise something I said on the podcast last week, which is that I don't think 2019 is the end for the 3DS. I don't think the 3DS is getting discontinued this year, but I think the end is closer than we thought. Because this also ties into the 3DS had surprisingly soft sales numbers this year. They had to halve the projections of the 3DS down from 4 million to like 2.6 million. So the 3DS is underperforming. It's sort of petering out faster than anyone thought. I think that's because the Switch is like rising faster than anyone thought. So clearly the 3DS's market share is just dwindling. And that probably, you know, is why a game like Persona Q, which again might be the last major release for the system, is not doing as well. So I think that's probably the explanation that this is not going to sell as well as other recent Persona games. Although, who knows? It could in the US, I guess. But I think the US has probably left the 3DS behind even more than Japan, where mobile gaming is more relevant, or handheld gaming is more relevant. But yeah, what are your thoughts on that, Sean?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is also, I can only imagine that dubbing, doing like a full dub localization of this game would be tremendously more expensive than the dancing games. Because, like, you know, not to say that there's not a lot of work that has to be put into doing the dub stuff for the dancing games, but there is, relatively speaking, far less text in those than there would be in this. Also, it's something that, since you've listened to the soundtrack, you know this. The last disc of the soundtrack, a bunch of the songs are, like, basically musical-style numbers of characters singing about who I think Hikari is, who's ever, like, it was one of the new characters for the game. And so it's, like, fully, like, I've not seen how they're integrated into the game, but it seems like there's fully produced musical numbers that are, like, central to the story with characters, like sing-talking about the story and stuff in a way that you would, if you were doing a dub, you'd have to do musical numbers and stuff like that and do all that shit. So it seems like that would be a lot of work. So I'm not necessarily hugely surprised at the dub not being there. I'm very glad the game is coming out over here, because it seemed weird to, we had gone a while without any announcements about it. It was kind of like with the dancing games, it felt like it took them longer than usual to announce what they were doing with the localizations of these games. And then for the 3DS stuff, it's a little bit, the 3DS is waning a little bit faster than I expected, but I don't think it's that surprising. But you have to keep in mind that it's still, like, it's selling several million.
Oh, yeah.
It's right. So it's like waning is relative. And that's why when we talked about last week, the question was about, like, are they, like, discontinuing the 3DS? And it's like, no, because Sony just discontinued the Vita last year. Like, that was the Vita. They're going to continue to, like, nominally support the console for several years to come, because there's no reason not to. But, like, this is, as you said with Persona Q2, we are seeing the last few, like, significant new games on the 3DS trickle out at the beginning of this year, and then it will continue. It'll be, like, weird small games made by third parties and stuff that, you know, is like, here's, you know, Barbie Dream Horse Adventure kind of things that will be on the 3DS, and that will be, like, the waning years of that console, as it is for all waning years of successful consoles.
Yes. And, you know, to be fair, 2.5 million units, the Vita would have killed for that literally any year. Any year.
Exactly.
Its first year, its second year, it would have killed for it. So, yes. We'll get back to the 3DS and hardware sales in a second. The last thing I'll say about Persona Q2, if you're disappointed about the dub, I totally get it. But I will say what I always say when you get a game that is not dubbed but is subtitled: be thankful you're getting it at all. Because that means it was a marginal case. That means that, like, they had limited resources to work with, and we are lucky to be getting it localized at all, because that is an expensive and time-consuming process. And to get it, like, this is the kind of game that would not have been localized 5-10 years ago. You know, it just wouldn't have.
Oh, yeah.
And we are in a much healthier space for game localizations, and if that means that more frequently we're getting ones without dubs, I think that's okay, because there's only so many resources to go around, even for something as big as Persona, and we're lucky to be getting as many of them as we are.
Yeah. Because also, did Persona Q 1 allow you to pick English or Japanese voices, or was it just English?
No, I think it's just English.
Yeah, so that's like the secret other part of this is like, oh, hey, but you're getting the Japanese voices, which for me, I love the English voices for Persona 3 and 4. Don't have enough experience with them with Persona 5, but like, secretly, this is like, oh, shit, yeah, I could get Persona Q2 and have the Japanese voices. Like, secretly, it makes me want the game more.
You don't have to pay $70 and buy a Japanese 3DS.
Yeah, because it's regional. 20 more hours playing the game because I have to read it in Japanese. Yeah, it's like, oh, shit, awesome.
Yes.
If I get a 3DS... there we go. Like, I can just get this version of the game and be happy with it.
And plush Koromaru.
That is a very good point.
All right.
And to reiterate, the soundtrack is really fucking good. So people looking forward to Persona Q2, it's got some good battle themes in it for sure.
Oh, it's got an insane number of, like, battle themes and vocal tracks, and all the vocalists from all the games are here doing their thing.
Yeah, and when you say all the games, that's including Persona 3 Portable, which was the part I wasn't expecting, because it's the female main character from Persona 3 Portable is also in the game. So they have, if you like the Persona 3 Portable soundtrack, which I do, you get some more of the songs in that style, and that was something I wasn't expecting and made me very, very happy when I was listening to that soundtrack.
It feels like it's the last kind of big celebration of this era of Persona. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because that team is done. You know, we're going to be moving on. They're going to be doing new things. I assume the spinoffs are going to slow down. And if there are more in the future, they'll probably be Persona 5 focused. This feels like it's a big, like, final party celebrating this era of Persona, which is cool. And I'm excited to play.
I'm still holding out hope for a Persona 5 arena that has a bunch of the Persona 3 and 4 characters in it. Please, Ark, make a Persona 5 arena.
They're rolling around in all that Dragon Ball money, Sean.
Exactly, but they're rolling so they can make a fucking Persona 5 arena game because they got all this money. All
right, so let's go ahead and move on. There were reports this week that Nintendo Switch's hardware update that we assume is coming is going to be some kind of Switch Mini. It would be smaller and presumably cheaper. It would come within fiscal year 2019. That gives us a broad window. It could be anywhere from April this year to March 2020. I think people would say that probably means summer 2019. This makes sense, I think. With what we just talked about, 3DS sales being softer than maybe expected, and software sales also apparently kind of down for 3DS, I think it's possible that this is what they do to sort of fill that slot in the 3DS's in the hardware line that the 3DS and the 2DS currently occupy, which is to say the cheaper alternative more aimed at kids that Nintendo sells. A smaller Switch, probably more focused on portability, could be what the hardware lineup sort of needs on that end. Again, not saying that they will completely discontinue the 3DS, but it would be like it would be a clear way, because the Switch as we have it now, there's some little things you could do to it, but this is not a situation like the original DS that had really dim screens and the really bulky, you know, design, or the original GBA that had no backlight, where it's like, this needs a redesign. The Switch doesn't have that, but I think a Switch Mini that would kind of clearly play the role like the 2DS has played for them makes a lot of sense. You get that down below 200, it probably sells a lot. And again, in the year that we're going to be having Animal Crossing and the new generation of Pokemon, I think this is probably right on the money of what they're going to be doing for the Switch.
Yeah, making more cost-effective, portable-leaning Switch definitely seems like it would make a lot of sense.
Yeah. I mean, I still see the predictions out there of people like, they're going to be doing the Switch Pro. We're going to get our 4K Switch. And I'm like, that's not Nintendo. And two, it didn't really work for Sony or Microsoft. Like, Nintendo doesn't really, like, go, like, loot the competition anyway and try to do what they're doing. But by all accounts, the PS4 Pro and the Xbox One X, like, they're popular with enthusiasts, but they're not, like, the highest-selling versions of those systems for obvious reasons. It makes way more sense to go the other direction, especially with a system whose main draw has never been and will never be its, you know, incredible horsepower. That's not what the Switch has been marketed on. So I think this makes total sense. It also makes me kind of breathe easier because it does not sound like we're going to be getting, like, you know, something that would make me need to upgrade my Switch.
Yeah, the new Nintendo Switch, like the new Nintendo 3DS,
yeah.
It's probably not going to be anything like that.
No, I don't think so. This makes sense to me. So I think we're getting that. And this, to put it all into context, comes as Nintendo released a bunch of their sales numbers. So we got this week details on basically fiscal year 2018. The Nintendo Switch has passed 32 million units sold so far in less than 2 years on the market. That tracks above the PS4, in line with the Wii. I don't know if anyone expects it to keep the exact same pace as the Nintendo Wii, but, you know, kind of anything's on the table, because it is selling faster than any of the current-gen systems, really faster than anything since the Wii. They also detailed some game statistics, and I found these interesting. Super Mario Party sold 5 million copies. That's fucking nuts. Pokemon Let's Go sold 10 million, and Smash Ultimate sold 12 million copies. And if you're thinking, oh, Smash always sells a lot of copies, the highest-selling Smash Bros. Game is Brawl, and it sold 13 million lifetime on the Wii. Like, Smash Bros. Clearly has gotten an enormous bump from the Nintendo Switch. Like, it's going to be far and away the highest-selling game in that series. It's almost the highest-selling game on the console, and it's only been out 2 months. The highest-selling game right now is Mario Kart 8 Deluxe at 15 million units, which, to remind you, is a port of a Wii U game, and it's the highest-selling game on the Switch, which is sort of incredible. I just find this all really interesting because those numbers are huge. To me, my main conclusion is that the Switch is performing, like, people want to make the Wii comparison for, like, the home console thing. The Switch, honestly, is performing a lot more like the Nintendo DS, the original DS, which people forget is the highest selling Nintendo system. It's almost the highest selling game console ever. It's like less than a million units below the PS2, so it's right there at the top of the chart. Like, statistically, they're actually probably in a dead heat. And the Nintendo DS, it had some of the, like, games for casual people, like Nintendogs or Brain Age, but Nintendo DS's success was based on games like New Super Mario Bros. And Pokemon games, like core, what you would call, for Nintendo fans, like the hardcore audience, but I just think the core audience is probably a better term. And Nintendo Switch is selling based on the core experiences, like Mario Kart, Zelda, Mario Odyssey, Smash Bros., as we see here. They're not having to do any of the Wii Sports sort of stuff, which, lest we forget, the Wii sold a lot of units, but had kind of weak software sales over the years because they focused a lot on those Wii Sports-style games, but they're actual, like, Smash Brawl only selling 13 million copies on the Wii, which had over 100 million units on the market, tells you a lot about the gap in audience on the Wii. The Switch is not having that problem. It's performing a lot more like the DS, and I think that's kind of fascinating, because it means that Nintendo's priorities and audience priorities are sort of aligned in a very clear way, and it kind of points to the sky being the limit here. I'm really curious where this goes. I mean, when a Mario Party game has sold 5 million units in 3 months, something is going on.
Yeah. One thing I am curious, like, thinking, like, looking towards the future, you know, looking towards the future, like, all video game stuff right now at the beginning of 2019 is, what is the new console thing with the next PlayStation, next Xbox? How is that going to disrupt the marketplace? Like, is that going to end up being competition in any way for Nintendo? Are Sony and Microsoft expecting or wanting to be competition? All that kind of stuff is something I'm really curious to see what happens as we approach E3 and stuff this year, as we get more and more information about what that next generation of consoles is going to be and how that's going to line up with the Switch stuff. Because one of the things about the Switch is it is in this awkward position where right now it's able to run decently, like, pared down ports of games that exist on the PS4 and Xbox One, like Doom and Wolfenstein. And those versions of those games seem to be doing fairly well on the Switch. But once you go over to the PS5 and Xbox One 2 or whatever it'll be called, presumably games built for those specs would not be able to, like, it wouldn't matter how much you pared it down. At some point, it wouldn't be able to run on the Switch. And so that's going to be something I'm just going to be curious to see how the third party reacts to that stuff, how Sony and Microsoft position it, because the Switch is doing really, really well. But one of the reasons why the Switch is doing well is that it exists so nicely in its own niche that it doesn't have to compete with Sony or Microsoft in any, like, real way.
Which means it's well-positioned for this generation turnover, you know.
Yeah.
Especially because Nintendo's own software is selling so well on it, as they usually do. They've got that shored up better than pretty much ever. I mean, we've got the highest-selling Smash game, the highest-selling Zelda game. Mario Odyssey is, I think, on its way to being one of the higher-selling Mario games. So, like, they're well-positioned there. I really am curious about this question, too, Sean, because there's no precedent for it, for a kind of disruptive console coming in mid-generation and sticking around to the next one. Usually that fails. The Dreamcast failed. The Wii U failed. Those would be the analogs, but they failed. This is like if the Dreamcast was a hit, what happens to the PS2? We don't know, because we don't live in that world. I'm curious. I mean, my big question is that, like, I'm really curious about the next generation for a number of reasons, mostly because I'm not sure what they're going to be selling those consoles on beyond more power. Because even the big hook for this next generation, which would have been 4K HDR, they used up that hook on the PS4 Pro and Xbox One X. And you can say, well, it's going to be more real 4K HDR in the next generation of systems. And that's true, but you can't do that in marketing. You can't say, not fake 4K anymore. Like, I don't know what you say about that, you know? Because they already, you go buy a PS4 Pro and it says real 4K on the box. So that line's been used up. They're going to be more powerful, but, like, I don't know what the, like, big next steps are in terms of, like, what, like, the killer features are going to be, the way we usually have in a new generation. Meanwhile, the Switch is out there effectively proving the point that power is not the first thing that sells systems, nor is it the last. Like, it's somewhere in there, but it is clearly not the most compelling thing to consumers. And I wonder, like, will Nintendo be hurt by this mid-generation refresh, or are the other consoles going to have to do something to keep up with this? I still think there's a possibility that third parties are going to keep looking at those growing Switch numbers and saying, do we want to stick with, like, just making, like, the most graphically advanced games possible, or do we want to try to get into that market? You know, Ubisoft has hedged their bets on that a little bit here and there, to mixed results. So, like, I'm very curious about all that. And it is going to be a big question. Like, this next generation, I feel like we're headed into uncharted territory on just about every level, because this doesn't feel like any other generation transition to me. And this is one of the big reasons.
Yeah, definitely. So it'll be something I'm really fascinated for a bunch of reasons what this year's E3 is going to be like. And slash E3 slash whatever Sony, whenever and however Sony is going to present the kind of information they would have presented at E3. Like, it's going to be a weird, interesting, like, transitional year for a lot of stuff in video games, which opens up Nintendo to have this nice spot where it's like everybody else is gearing up and Nintendo's like, fuck it, we can just put out Animal Crossing Pokemon and we can just keep on trucking along because they're in, like, the middle part of their console now.
Yes. So I'm very fascinated with where this is all going. Speaking of Super Smash Bros. Ultimate, Masahiro Sakurai, I just wanted to share this because I thought it was kind of an amazing statistic. He does columns in Famitsu, the Japanese gaming magazine, every so often. And in this week's column, he had permission from Nintendo to share some of their online data about Smash Ultimate. And because Sakurai is, you know, a total nerd, he wanted to nerd out over this. So he shared some of their online data. And I'm just going to quote here. This is Nintendo Everything did a translation of this. And they said, as for one-on-one victory rates, no fighter is lower than 40% and no fighter exceeds 60%. In terms of elite one-on-one matches, the character with the lowest percentage sits at 43%, while the character with the highest rate is 57%. There's a noticeable difference there, but considering that those percentages are for the highest and lowest of 74 fighters, overall you could say that the characters were fairly close to each other. Later down, even taking into account one-on-one matches outside of Elite Smash, every fighter has a win rate of somewhere between 40 and 54%, and those with a 45% win rate comprise 90% of the total fighters. And I just found that really interesting because that is, like, actual empirical data, like, statistical data to try to figure out, like, how balanced is Super Smash Bros. Ultimate, and it's pretty fucking balanced if those are the numbers. And again, this is a game with 74 fighters. From my personal experience, they are the most differentiated set of fighters Smash Bros. Has ever had. They play the most differently. There are the most differences between characters. It is the hardest to master new characters. And you would expect in that case balancing would be significantly harder, and yet the balancing is actually it's in the statistical range you would want it to be, and I find that really curious. Like, there's even a paragraph in that article where he talks about, like, you know, people think King K. Rool is sort of overpowered, but actually his win rate is under 50%. People seem to have a lot of trouble, like, fully figuring out how to use him. And so he even takes kind of a little pot shot at, like, all of the ranking lists out online where he points out, like, you know, we can all have our own, like, individual opinions, and there are certainly pros who have their opinions on this, but, like, in terms of the actual player base, here are the numbers. And that's cool. I wish people shared, like, online data like that more, because it's really interesting. Yeah. And it should be another feather in Smash Ultimate's cap, because that actually, I feel like that's a pretty impressive achievement given the number of fighters in the game.
Yeah, it's a little hard to parse some of that data, just in the sense of, like, we have nothing to compare it to, because fucking nobody like, exposes that kind of data, because it does also, I'm curious, so, like, for instance, like, a character like King K. Rool, who I'm just assuming, based on the way that people talk about him, is at the top of what are called tier lists that pros put together for, like, fighting game tier lists. Okay, this is basically one of the best characters, so, like, you know, classically in Dragon Ball FighterZ, Bardock for the longest time has been, like, a tier one, like, top of the tier list character because of how versatile he is and how much damage output he can have if you know what you're doing with him. But one thing I'm curious is, like, with the breakdown of how many of those, like, the victory rate for those characters, if you broke out, like, the rankings and relative skill of the players, how much does that shift for, like, in a really high skill level match, is King K. Rool then much, much better than Kirby or Jigglypuff or whoever, you know, I don't know who a low tier character is, but someone like that, versus in the general online population, it's hard to get, like, the full damage potential or whatever of King K. Rool, and so a lot of people who think they can do well with him try to play as that character and then fucking fall flat on their face because they actually don't know how to use him well.
And right, totally, and I mean, the correct approach is to balance for the overall player population, not for the pros.
Yeah.
And I feel like they've done that clearly very well. But yeah, it is an interesting question. But, you know, I think of other fighting games I know, like a Dragon Ball FighterZ. Like, I have to imagine, like, I don't know, a character like Tien used online probably has lower than 40% win rate.
Like, Tenshin Han actually is he's like a middle-tier character from what I understand. You're thinking more like base Goku is pretty low-tier. Although they just put out a huge patch that has probably, like, changed fucking everything about how that works for, like, high-level shit. And this is, like I am nowhere near good enough at the game to be able to engage with, like, my base Goku is just as good as my Super Saiyan Vegeta, even though Super Saiyan Vegeta is, like, near the top of the tier list, and base Goku is, like, near the bottom. And, like, Krillin is a really low-tier character, I know. But, yeah, I don't have no idea what the relative win-loss percentage is and stuff like that, because companies just tend not to put that kind of data out there, which is a bummer.
They should. It's fascinating. I want the data to compare this to. Like, if Dragon Ball FighterZ did that, that'd be really cool, because they have it. That's how they do balancing, is they have to test it and look at what works, especially once it's online and has a player population to draw data from. But yeah, anyway, I just thought that was, like, it was very nerdy, and I liked it, and we don't get that kind of news with video games much, so thank you, Sakurai.
Yes, thank you, Sakurai, for all your hard work.
For all your hard work. All right, finally, the most what-the-fuck news of the week is that apparently, and you guys, we are recording this Sunday night. This podcast is coming out Monday morning. By the time you're listening to this, you will know more about this than we do. But apparently, tomorrow morning, Monday, sometime during the day, we will be getting a free-to-play Titanfall game that is a Battle Royale game, but it won't have the Titans, so I don't see how it's Titanfall. It's apparently called Apex Legends. It is a respawn game. Jason Schreier's reporting at Kotaku sort of puts the pieces together that it's a holdover for a Titanfall 3 that seemingly has been internally delayed because they think the engine it's running on, which is Source, is too old and outdated, and this is like some kind of holdover for that. Or this could be a test of Titanfall within the Frostbite engine. We're not sure either way. But you know, when I first heard about this, Sean, I thought to myself, hey, Titanfall, like a Battle Royale game with Titans, that could be awesome. And they said, oh, there's no Titans. And I said, nobody wants that. Nobody's ever wanted that. Titanfall without the Titans is just Fall. No one wants to play a game called Fall, because then you're just playing kind of shitty Call of Duty. The Titans are the fun part. What the hell?
Yeah, I mean, I do, I have a hard time figuring out how the Titans would work in a Battle Royale mode, because that just seems like...
That's their impossible. Job, not mine.
Yeah, that just seems really hard. So it seems like kind of a weird fit in that sense for Titanfall. And yeah, like, as you said, this is, like, weird developing rumors and stuff that seem, like, semi-substantiated, but, like, a lot of those tweets by Jason Schreier were very much couched in a, like, this is not, like, this is not a big, like, you know, 2,000-word article about, like, the history of Titanfall and this new game that's coming out by Jason Schreier, right? So it's very mysterious and up in the air about what all this stuff is. When I first heard about it, I thought they were talking about, like, oh, this is going to be some weird, like, free-to-play Titanfall game that exists in the Chinese market only, in the way that there's, like, I don't know if you know this, Jonathan, but there's a weird free-to-play Call of Duty that exists in the Asian market, particularly for China, that is, like, based on Modern Warfare and Modern Warfare 2, that has, like, Modern Warfare maps, like, shipment and stuff in it, but it's totally online and free-to-play and all this weird shit. And it's on PCs and all this stuff. It's like... This is a weird other version of this game that you know very well that exists in a form that you do not know very well. I think there's a version of Halo that's like that also. And that's why I thought this was. That doesn't seem like what they're saying. They seem to be saying it's like, nope, this is just like worldwide, some free-to-play Titanfall game that doesn't have Titans, but is Battle Royale, and it's made by Respawn, and they probably will have a Titanfall 3 eventually, but who knows?
It's just so weird. It's so weird to like... Because if it were a Chinese market game, like, that actually makes way more sense to me. I would not bat an eyelash at that. Weird stuff comes out in those markets all the time. But I don't know. It feels like chopping your own feet off to do a Titanfall game without the Titans. I don't know. It would be like if Avengers Endgame had none of the Avengers in it. And it's just like people hanging out in a cafe talking about the Avengers. It's like, I want to see the Avengers. You called it Avengers. What the hell are you doing? No one wants Apex Legends. What the fuck is this? Sounds like a weird new superhero show with like a bunch of like D-rate X-Men or something. I don't know. We'll see. It just
feels like the Titanfall franchise is floundering. Like, it's just in such a weird spot where, like, Titanfall 2 was a very good game in its own right. I didn't like it as much as a lot of people did, because a lot of people really fucking love that campaign. I think it's a good campaign that has like that is fun to play through once, and I don't think I'd ever go back to it. But it's like, that was a good game, but it just is, I think Titanfall has a really hard time of trying to grab onto anything in like the largest sort of like mainstream zeitgeist of video games. Like, it just, you know, it can't dig its claws in the way that certainly Call of Duty did, but even the game, like something slightly smaller tier, like a Battlefield or even like Halo now manages to hold on to some sort of like mind share. And I feel like Titanfall is this franchise that keeps on getting close to being able to do that, but just can't quite nail it yet. And, you know, maybe this will help them. Maybe being free-to-play will make it work, but who knows.
Except it doesn't have the Titans. So it's like, and it's not going to be billed as Titanfall. So I don't know. It's a weird thing. The Battle Royale thing is weird to me, too, because it feels like all the Battle Royale clones are coming in weird fits and starts, and this feels like it's kind of missed the mark because it doesn't seem like anyone's really even trying to compete with Firewatch. What's the fuck's it called?
Fortnite,
yeah, that one. That's what I meant.
Yes, the biggest game in the world, Fortnite. Yes,
Sean, you know as much about Fortnite as I do, which is zilch. So, come on.
I know that the juniors in my class are playing. They play a lot of the Fortnite.
Okay, I don't.
So I know that they're doing that.
I do not work with high schoolers anymore. I used to, so I probably I would be more inundated with Fortnite, but I don't think the college kids are playing Fortnite. So.
Who knows? They're all playing Fortnite. We're the only ones who aren't playing it, Jonathan.
Yeah, but that's my point. I don't know if you're ripping people away from Fortnite.
No, and because you're not ripping people away from Fortnite, like PUBG, even though people don't talk about it, still has like millions of people that play it. And then from what I understand, that Call of Duty Blackout mode, which is the mode from Black Ops 4 that is a Battle Royale thing, seems to be doing really well. It actually seems kind of cool.
Yeah, I would like to play that.
Yeah, it seems like a much slicker version of one of those modes, which made it make a lot more sense when I saw videos of it. Of like, oh, here's what like a fully developed game made by like a well-funded company of like veteran developers making this mode on a like well-worn and used engine. It's like, this is a well-oiled machine making this version of this mode. I understand what Battle Royale is just from having seen like a video of a match of Blackout mode, and so I kind of want to play that.
I do. There was a sale on Black Ops 4 at Best Buy the other day, and I almost bought it, and I still might at some point if it goes down like below $20, because I would... That sounds like $20 worth of fun.
Yeah, and just like a way to be like, okay, I want to understand what the fuck these modes are and why people are making them, why EA is so desperate. They're making a free-to-play Titanfall version of it.
Yes.
Yeah, Black Ops seems to be the one to go to for that.
Speaking of Call of Duty, this was not on our outline, but as a little addendum to our topic last week on 2019 preview, we did not talk about Call of Duty, I realized.
That's true.
And I just want to do our quick, like, you can attach this, you can cut this out and paste it onto our 2019 preview if you need continuity there. Mm-hmm. Call of Duty this year, the next developer in the barrel is Infinity Ward.
Yes.
Last time they were at bat, they made Call of Duty Infinite Warfare, which has one of the best first-person shooter campaigns ever made. It's on that same tier with Doom and Halo 1, and it is a masterpiece that never gets its day in the sun, but it should because it's amazing. We both agree on that.
It's a much better campaign than Titanfall 2's campaign, and I will fucking die on that hill.
Yes. It's amazing. It's the best Call of Duty campaign. Infinite Warfare, a lot of the babies on the internet, you know, shit their pants over it and cried and cried and cried and threw a tantrum. And so then they did a World War II game, and then they did a Black Ops game with no campaign at all. What do you think Infinity Ward is doing this year? Do you think there will be another campaign? Are they done with that with Call of Duty? Black Ops 4 seemed like it went over pretty well. I don't think it lit the world on fire, but people certainly liked it. I don't know.
I have no idea what this game is going to be, in the sense of I do not know what the setting is going to be, because I don't think it's going to be another space game, because that seems like that would be a bad fucking move. I also would be surprised if they made a World War II game. So I don't know. I have no, maybe we come full circle and it's just Modern Warfare. It's like, we're back. Infinity Ward, Call of Duty Modern Warfare, here we go again. I mean, it's been 12 years since the first Modern Warfare, and so Modern Warfare has changed enough in that, those 12 years, that maybe they can do it again. I don't know.
I think if I were putting money down, I think you're probably right. It feels like a lot of the franchises that died last generation they're like dipping their toes in the water to see if they can come back. Like they did that with Guitar Hero a couple years ago, remember? And Rock Band.
Yeah. Guitar Hero
stuff
Live.
Like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I feel like that's probably because they also Infinite Warfare came with that Modern Warfare remaster. Mm-hmm. So I think that could be what they're doing. Modern Warfare 4, Modern Warfare. But yeah, I don't, it's definitely not Infinite Warfare 2, which is too bad because that was a great game.
Yeah. And I bet it does have a campaign, because everything the sense I get from Black Ops 4 is that, I mean, we know it was supposed to have a campaign. The campaign just kind of fell apart, and so they're like, "Eh, fuck it!" And so, because we can't delay the game because we have this whole weird yearly schedule thing with Activision, so fuck it, we'll just rip the campaign out and like make weird tutorial missions or whatever, and that's what we'll do with the campaign stuff we built. It never felt like it was on purpose that they took the campaign out. So I think Infinity Ward is a campaign in their game. I bet we still have a campaign the next year. My bet is that Treyarch does never makes a campaign for Call of Duty again. And then past that, maybe Infinity Ward and Sledgehammer, if Call of Duty keeps on going for that long, I bet by the time the cycle comes around fully again, or at Treyarch, campaigns are done. That's my thought.
That could very well be true. There's time if Sledgehammer decides not to do it, because they're at least 2 years out. But yeah, I mean, I think the real question is, when does Call of Duty like just go fucking free to play or something?
Yeah,
you know?
Just fully abandoned. I mean, they sell more than enough copies that it's still going really strong. But yeah, it's. I mean, I thought, you know, I bet if you go back to a podcast that we made around the time the PS4 was coming out, we were like, you know, Call of Duty probably has a couple more games in it, and this is the generation where Call of Duty dies, like halfway through or something.
Oh no, definitely not.
And that did not happen. And I feel like, my thoughts on Call of Duty right now are the exact same thoughts and feelings I had on Call of Duty at the end of the last generation of consoles, when we were about like Modern Warfare 3, Black Ops 2, that period. I'm like, I think Call of Duty's kind of running out of steam. We maybe get a couple more, as like, you know, Ghost had such a poor launch at the beginning of this console cycle. It's like, we got like two more of these and then it's over. I feel that way now. And so I'm sure that the PS5 will go its entire lifespan having a Call of Duty game come out every fucking year and still selling like 8 million copies or something on launch day.
Probably. Which is fine, you know.
I just want to learn from the mistakes of my past, so I'm going to overcompensate.
All right. Let's go ahead and move on, Sean. You want to talk about some video games?
Let's talk about the video games we've been playing, Jonathan.
Well, we've both been playing some fighting games because Dragon Ball FighterZ got its second season of DLC off the ground with Videl and Jiren, and they're awesome, and we'll talk about that in a second. And Super Smash Bros. Got its DLC off the ground with its first DLC character who was free to anyone who had purchased the game, Piranha Plant. Piranha Plant is sort of a different kind of fighter than we've had before. For one, he has no limbs, which is weird. But also, Piranha Plant is sort of... he's the first character who is not really a character in Smash Brothers. He's an enemy type, right? And I'm saying and that doesn't even make any sense. It's a fucking plant. It has no conception of gender or even of sex. So, this genderless plant is in the game. It is by far the weirdest fucking fighter in Smash Brothers. I've been playing with it. I'm not very good with Piranha Plant, but I would not doubt that there is some pro somewhere in the world gearing up to win a fucking international tournament with Piranha Plant come July 2019. But yeah, he's a very interesting fighter. They, again, no limbs, just got some stems on the side, like some little like leg-esque things that stick out of the bottom of the plant of the pot when he needs to move. It's wild. It's very funny. It is a fact, like, you can use it in a match. It's definitely a fully built out fighter that is as well thought out as the other ones. It's got a very fun final smash that where the Petey Piranha comes out and like bangs characters around. My favorite move is he has a really great upgrade move where he uses his leaves to fly up. Like, a lot of characters have that, like Link's, you know, sword move sort of thing. But Piranha Plant's is directional and you can kind of fly around the map with it and you can do some cool moves that way. His neutral B spits out a big spiky ball, and this is the only neutral B I know of that works like this, where you have to neutral B and then do a directional input to make the spiky ball go somewhere. So it's actually a much harder move to use than most neutral Bs, but if you can do it, it can do some serious damage. He's got this like poison cloud that is your left or right B special move, and that's really interesting. He's a fun character. He is, as I said, kind of difficult to figure out how to use, but you know, my brother and I have played with him online a little bit, and I did his whole classic mode, which is where he fights all of the other new characters in Smash Ultimate, and that was fun. So yeah, you know, it's a good DLC character. It definitely is a good preview for what we're going to be getting, where we know we're at least getting Joker, and then we're presumably getting a lot of other new characters who we have not, you know, had in Smash Bros. Before, and it is a lot of fun. But it is a weird character, and it weirds me out a little bit, I have to admit. It's a little freaky.
Freaky seems like the right word. I don't know if I would ever play as Piranha Plant, because he creeps me out.
Yeah, he creeps me out a little bit, too. I did pay homage to Piranha Plant in our theme song this week. This was an esoteric enough theme song choice that I feel the need to explain it. I played Mean Green Mother from Outer Space from Little Shop of Horrors, because that song was just playing in my head as I was playing as Piranha Plant.
Fair enough.
Because Petey Piranha is totally, he is Audrey 2 from Little Shop of Horrors. That's totally what he is, and especially in this game. I can imagine Sakurai in the office playing that song while they program the character. So anyway, there you go. Go watch Little Shop of Horrors, I guess, is the... No, wait, we were talking about Smash Bros.
Go watch Little Shop of Horrors, and then if you own Smash Bros. Ultimate, download Piranha Plant and freak yourself out, because he's kind of creepy.
Yes. But, you know who's not creepy? Videl and Jiren. I mean, Jiren's a little creepy, I guess, because he can fucking kill you, but he's also cool. Oh my god, Sean, they're so good.
Yeah, they're awesome. Man, they're two really awesome characters, but I think I like Videl a bit more because she's... Man, Videl, like, the way they've integrated Videl into the game is just fucking amazing.
Yeah.
Like, it's... So yeah, so we have Videl and Jiren for the first two characters for Season 2 of Dragon Ball FighterZ DLC. And based off of these two characters, what I'm guessing we are getting are for the remaining four, because there's only six for this season, are characters that are probably going to be very different in how they play from the rest of the cast. Because for the first season, we had a bunch of characters that were like, you know, obviously weren't like the same as any of the characters. All the characters are different and play differently, have different specials and everything. But characters like Bardock especially, Vegito to a certain extent, Base Goku and Base Vegeta, all those characters are pretty similar to a lot of the main cast in Dragon Ball FighterZ. You know, they share a lot of similarities with your Super Saiyan Gokus and Super Saiyan Vegetas and sort of like the primary cast members. And you would get a couple of characters like a Broly. Cooler and Android 17 are both a little bit weird. Merge Zamasu is definitely a more esoteric, kind of strange character in how he plays. But generally speaking, the Season 1 characters were fairly expected and, like, understandable and relative to the rest of the main cast. Videl and Jiren both feel like really unique characters. Jiren is mostly a counter character, which we don't really have in Dragon Ball FighterZ. With, like, Hit is the closest. Hit has a couple of counter moves. But Jiren has two full counter moves. He has his a physical counter that changes based on whether you want to do a mid block, a low block, or his like EX move that costs 1 meter if you do quarter circle back in heavy attack. That is just this super fast counter that will block any physical attack that hits you. But he also has a counter that blocks any projectile attacks. So he has full counters for any type of attack that can hit him, other than obviously like level 3 supers and like crazy shit that you can't counter. He has a bunch of different command grabs, so he's really weird because his standing heavy is not
good.
Yeah, his standing heavy, which this is not something I think any other character in the game has a move that is like this. Instead of it just being a like Smash style like big heavy attack that hits the character and sends him launching across the screen, it's a fucking command grab. And in fighting games, what a command grab is, it is a special kind of throw move that is not just like the generic throw that every character has. So, you know, like Street Fighter 2, Ryu can just like throw a guy, but Zangief has special inputs you can do that do a special command throw or command grab that is his own special move. So Jiren has a couple of command grabs, one of which just being his normal neutral heavy attack, which is fucking nuts. So his normal heavy attack is he just reaches up, grabs the enemy, like you can't block it because it's a throw, and he just does the thing that he does to Super Saiyan Blue Vegeta, where he just puts a big energy ball right to his chest and fucking blasts him across the screen. That's nuts. His launcher attack, his down heavy, switches sides, so he like kicks you up and throw instead of every other launcher in the game, every other down heavy launches the character up into the sky, like right above you. His launches them up behind him over his head towards the other side of the screen at like a super high speed, which is fucking nuts. If you do a down heavy in the air instead of doing a launcher, he spins and like crashes and hits them to the ground. So it's like a lot of, it's not just his special attacks that differentiates him. A lot of his normals are fucking weird. So if you go into the game expecting to be able to mash out the same kinds of combos that you could do with Goku and Vegeta and Gohan and Vegito and like 90% of the cast of the game, you will like hit weird roadblocks of like all of his launchers do different stuff. A lot of his normal attacks do different kinds of things. And that's fucking nuts and cool. And it took me a while to get used to it, and I still am not nowhere near good enough with him to be able to counter stuff in any reliable sort of way. But a lot of his combos and the kinds of specials he can pull out, when you pull out something good with Jiren, you feel so fucking powerful and so, like, he just knocks people around the screen and throws them around and blasts them all over the place, and it's a really good representation of his character.
He's so good, and you know, one of the things I had so much fun realizing while I was fighting him is that he's one of the few characters in Dragon Ball FighterZ who is truly new to this generation of the show. Because we have Beerus, we have Zamasu, and we have Hit.
Goku Black.
Well, Goku Black is Goku, though. Like, I know he plays very differently, sure. But he is technically, like, his character design is Goku. So I'm just thinking, like, people who, like, head to toe are new character designs, you know?
Okay,
like,
yeah.
Hit and Beerus and Zamas. Goku Black is kind of a weird, like, middle ground character. But this guy, like, oh, no, this is, like, it was fun for me because I'm like, I have not played as Jiren in another fighting game. Like, there's nothing to compare him to. And there's not a ton of characters in FighterZ you can say that about. And that's not a problem with FighterZ. It's just that, like, you know, we have had so many cool new characters, and I like getting another one of them represented here. He's so well represented. It is, like, he really, like, the tone of Jiren comes across in that he is, like, terrifyingly powerful. He is fast. He is, like, really, like, as you say, he's got a lot of power and he's very effective. But there's also just, I love the just sort of speed component of it, that, like, everything he does is, like, ruthless and precise. And, you know, he has his main, like, special move, the B button. For you, it would be the X button. For people on Xbox, it would be the A button. This is the weird thing about modern controllers, he does the punch that, like, sends energy across the screen, and that's so cool. His ultimate is unbelievable. It's so nice. And just the animation and everything, it's really something else. I love his intro animation where he's doing his meditation and then gets up. And yeah, I was really happy to have Jiren in the game. And it also was just a reminder of like, right, we've got all these cool new characters in Dragon Ball now. And you know, you could have a fight between Jiren and Hit in this game. And that's great. Or Jiren and Beerus. And we can have fights between and with all new characters. And Goku Black, if you want to throw him in there too. That's all just really, really neat.
Yeah, Jiren also has, I think, probably my favorite light auto combo in the game, where if you just mash the light attack button and you get that auto combo, like, his sort of the finisher for that auto combo is he does that thing where he, like, I think he does this to Hit in the show, where he launches him up into the sky and then, like, explodes with this energy beam, and he turns around and folds his arm and just says, "Wadida." And fucking awesome.
I won a match that way earlier today where I had Jiren come in for like the last little bit of health, and it was perfect. It worked so well. Those little like cinematic moments you can make with Dragon Ball FighterZ are so fun.
Yeah, Jiren is the character that like I'm most excited to see at like Evo or whatever, the next big fighting game tournament. I want to see a pro level player like a Sonic Fox or a Goichi get really good at playing Jiren and see what that looks like. Because I feel like there's just some master level crazy bullshit you could do with Jiren with all of his counters and some of his like, just like, it feels like he is a character that when you master him, he has got to be able to output just an absurd amount of damage, because he can like blast characters across the whole screen and do all this weird shit with wall bounces. Like, he seems just fucking, like, I can't do most in like almost anything good with him, but I watched a combo video of him just to get a sense of like, how would someone who's good at this game play this character, and how can I get close enough to emulate that to be able to play him in this fucking game? And it just seemed like, holy shit, this is someone figuring out a combo with this character after one day, and the shit they're doing seems nuts. He seems like a character that's going to have a high skill level, or a high like skill ceiling, but there's a lot that I'm hoping pros are going to pull out of him.
You know the combo challenge mode in tutorial, where it walks you through a bunch of combos? I did that for I've done it for all the characters. I do it to like grind Zenny in the game, and just to like introduce myself to the characters. I usually can do like 7 or 8 of the combos, and then the last 2 or 3 I am not good enough for.
Yeah, the last two are like, because the first like 7 are like, here's like super basic like auto combo kind of stuff, and the last 2 are like, okay, this is an actual like basic combo with this character. You need to have your shit together to be able to do it.
Yeah, and have you seen Jiren's for those? Did you go through that with him?
I haven't done Jiren and Videl's
yet. It's the fucking funniest. Like, I saw the one for level 8 and I just about had a heart attack because the number of inputs on screen scared me. Like, I dropped out. I never really do the level 8 or 10 or 9 or 10 ones, but I saw that one and I was just like, nope, that's not for me. It is, because I've done all of them, it is the most convoluted one I've seen in the game. So
it definitely seems like he is a pretty technical character, but even if you aren't that good at the game, that you can still like, don't get, I think like calling him a counter character probably like scares off newbie level fighting game players like me, because there are counter characters in other fighting games I've played that I'm like, I just can't do anything, that like nothing this character does makes sense. Like, he still plays enough like a Dragon Ball FighterZ character that you can have a lot of fun with him.
I found
and kind of ignore the counters.
I found him easier to use than like Cooler or Hit, who I also think of as very technical. Like, Hit, I think is awesome, but I always have trouble with. Jiren, I obviously am not going to be able to do the high level stuff, but I was able to I did a full arcade run, and like, Jiren was pretty like terrifyingly powerful throughout that. Like, he definitely works for different skill levels in a way that like, Hit, you have to be good at, I feel like, to use.
Yeah. I can't do anything with Hit. Like, no. He's a difficult character to get your heads around, for sure.
Yeah, I would not compare him to the Jiren in that way. So, yeah. But, so like I was saying, you know, Jiren is a new character we've seen before. Videl has been in Dragon Ball fighting games before, but Videl has always been in that category of, like, the joke characters they throw in, like Mr. Satan or something like that, where it's a character who really never participates in the big fights in the series, so they have to find kind of convoluted ways to get them into the chaos, and you really use them for gags more than serious fights. That's not Videl in Dragon Ball FighterZ. Videl in Dragon Ball FighterZ is as much a fighter as anyone else. She is fucking awesome. She has a very unique moveset. It's more like a wrestler or something. There's a lot of like grabs and really interesting moves that way. There's all the ways that the Patriots won the fucking Super Bowl. God damn it. I'm seeing the update here. Well, again, I just want bad things to happen to bad people once in a while. That's all. That's, you know, just fucking Tom Brady's a douchebag. They fucking cheat and they win. I feel like it's sending a bad message to the youth of America.
Yeah. No, the Patriots winning the Super Bowl is like Popovich beating Vidal in the World Martial Arts Tournament. It's just something that shouldn't have happened.
Yeah, thank you for getting us back into the flow of things, because I saw that and I just kind of lost the train of thought.
Yeah, for a second I thought that you forgot, like, who Great Sandman was or something. You tried to say Great Sandman, you couldn't think of it, and were just so ashamed by it. I was very confused for a
moment. No. But I was saying, yes, I love all the ways she interacts with Great Sandman. I love hearing Yuko Minoguchi in there, and they have some great, like, contextual voice lines for her. Mm-hmm. But it's fun. You know, I was doing a fucking battle where I was fighting Videl versus, you know, fucking Kid Boo. And it's like, and she's kicking his ass. And I'm like, I love that they've made a game where this doesn't feel ridiculous. This feels like they've done the work to make Videl feel like the character who could do this. It's a really cool accomplishment.
Yeah, like, I'm so impressed with what they did with Videl. And she is, of these two, she's the one I like playing more. I think she's a lot of fun to play. And the thing that I'm most impressed by is that, for the longest time, I thought Videl would not be in this game. Like, when people were, like, hypothesizing about DLC characters, a lot of people were saying Videl, and I wanted Videl to be in the game, partially just because, like, you know, Dragon Ball has so few female characters that could even be in a game like this that it gets frustrating as, like, the roster is so loaded with male characters. That's, like, Videl, I understood, like, why everyone really wants Videl in the game, but it just felt like with the methodology that Arc applies with employing characters in Dragon Ball FighterZ, it's not like a lot of other Dragon Ball games where they're like, with this, their super attacks, we'll obviously, like, Goku's going to do a Kamehameha, whatever, like, we'll pull stuff from the show, but generally speaking, like, everyone, like, you know, everybody's normal punching combos basically look like everyone else's. Like, that feels like what most Dragon Ball games are like. With Dragon Ball FighterZ, like, literally every single thing a character does feels like it is pulled from something from the source material. Whether it's your standing medium punch or it's your level 3 super, everything is, like, you can look at the keyframe animations of your normal attacks and look at, like, a page from the manga and pull out, here's where this kick is, here's where this throw is. Like, here's, like, they, like, literally match the animations. Like, if you, like, flip the character or whatever, you see it's, like, it matches the body position perfectly. That's how so much of what Arc System Works has done with this game. And Videl has, like, one real fight in the manga with Popovich, like a couple of little, what, like, ones from, like, the filler in the anime of her beating up goons, like a couple of scenes from, like, movie 2 or the second Broly movie, and I guess, like, Wrath of the Dragon, I think she does some Great Sandman 2 stuff in, but generally speaking, there's very little content to pull Videl from for this game, so I just thought they would never do her. And that coupled with the fact that she can't really use key attacks, which is a core basic thing that every other character in the game has. It's like a whole button on the controller is dedicated to, here's your normal key projectile attack. Videl has literally none. She can't do that. She's never shown to be able to do that. The only thing she can do with her key is fly. And so I thought for the longest time she would not be in this game. And the decision of, okay, then let's do Videl as a team-up character, kind of like Captain Ginyu and Android 18 with Android 17, and have Great Sandman be, that is your, like, special attack button. That is your projectile. It's just fucking Great Sandman comes out. And so Great Sandman is not a special attack. He's not like Android 17 in that sense. He's a little bit more like Captain Ginyu, where in Captain Ginyu in the game, you just press the special button on the controller, and one of the Ginyu Force pops out and doesn't move. That's what Great Sandman does. So depending on if you're in the air or what direction you're pushing, Great Sandman will come out and do another different kind of attack. But that's the only time that Great Sandman really enters is in that situation and when you do your level 3 super. And so it really feels like you're playing as Videl 95% of the time, and every once in a while Great Sandman comes in and does an additional attack. And so that's a really smart implementation of Great Sandman. Sandman does not overwrite Videl as feeling like she is the main character you're playing as most of the time. It's not like half the time you're playing Sandman, half the time you're playing Videl. And it's a good way to make up for the fact that she doesn't have any projectile attacks normally on her own. But then the other smart thing they did with her is, as you pointed out, she plays like a wrestler. And so she has all these different kinds of grab moves. She has, like you know, she will do this, like, diving knee attack and grab onto a person and flip them over. She has all these, like, interesting high kicks and stuff that she will do. And she's also a, I think it's called a Rinsa character. I forget what the technical fighting game term for it is. But she is like Yamcha or Android 17, Super Android 17, or Android 17 for Dragon Ball Super in the game.
No, not Super Android 17. Android 17, comma, from Dragon Ball Super. Super.
Yeah, exactly. Those are two different characters because Dragon Ball is going along enough that it gets very confusing. But she's, I think it's called a Rinsa character. She's the kind of character that her, like, quarter circle forward melee attack, it chains together into different kinds of moves. So, like Yamcha's Wolf Fang Fist, if you do quarter circle forward light and then start the chain, and you keep on mashing on light, it will do one kind of chain of attacks. But if in the middle you pick medium, she will flip over and do this, like, cool cross-up attack and kick them in the back of the head. And so she has all these really technical melee-focused kinds of attacks and lots of grabs that makes her feel like she's this kind of, like, wrestling, kind of, like, grappler, like, get in your face and fuck you up, like, very physical melee character, which one feels pretty different. So it's like she most, like, her closest analog is probably Yamcha in the game. And it's like kind of like an interesting, like, she's one part Yamcha, one part Captain Ginyu with the Great Saiyaman stuff, which is a really interesting setup for a character. And yeah, like, I just think she's a ton of fucking fun to play as. She has one of my favorite looking level 3 supers in the game, with Great Saiyaman coming in and doing this big chain attack and then flipping up and doing that giant kick into the your enemy's face, and they do this huge sliding knockback along the ground of the stage. She's just so much fucking fun to play as, and I'm just so happy that they found a way to implement her into the game, make her a totally, what feels like a totally viable character, and she feels 100% like, this is, I am playing as Videl, these are the kinds of moves that Videl does, these are the kind of specials that she would have, and all the integration with the Great Saiyaman feels very slick and effective.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. It's surprising how well she plays. That, like, to me, I found her a little more intuitive than the other Rinsa characters you mentioned, like Android 17 and Yamcha. I found Videl a little easier, not easier to use, but, like, I got it a little faster. And part of it is, like, the animations on the wrestling stuff are really good. Like, they have such propulsion chaining into them. It's such a great little connection to, like, of course that's how she would fight. Mr. Satan, that's what he is. He's a wrestler. That's what he would have taught her. Like, they don't say it in the show, like, but that's obviously who what Mr. Satan is. So it's just, it's really cool. It's joyous. It's fun, but it's not just empty fan service. Like the rest of Dragon Ball FighterZ, it feels like, you know, their commitment to this is always 100%, and Videl definitely feels like they took on a challenge and rose to the occasion, and she's someone who will totally be in my rotating roster going forward. She's awesome.
Also, I don't know if you know this, Jonathan, but I don't know what the button combination is on the Switch, but if on PS4, if you hold down L1 while you pick Videl, she is Pigtail Videl, and Great Saiyaman has the helmet on instead of the World Martial Arts Tournament outfit. And she's the only character in the game that has that. She has a whole separate costume, which is for, like, her other, like, her original look before she cuts her hair. And that's fucking amazing. And that's one of the other things about Videl, is I think she is, her and Great Saiyaman's animations, I think, are the best looking in the game. Like, all the stuff with, like, her shirt, which kind of, like, is, like, this big open shirt that kind of, like, billows a little bit. And then Great Saiyaman's cape. Like, the animation is so fucking gorgeous on those flowing elements with those two characters, particularly when they're on screen together. Like, she has the best, like, end-fight animation. Like, I want to end every round with Videl because I want to see, like, Saiyaman pop in and, like, sweep the cape around and then them standing back-to-back with their arms folded while Saiyaman's, like, bright red cape billows in the wind. They're the most gorgeous-looking fighters in the game.
I think it's true, and I think the big thing is that there's a lot more they can do with the clothing and, like, the clothing design, because most of the other fighters have either, like, basic gi on, or even less in some cases. You know, Broly is just fucking buff Broly, right? So, like, there's sort of more to work with in like, it feels very Toriyama to me, because this is less about the, like, big buff fighters. You know, Videl is not this, like, giant hulking monstrosity or anything. Not that every character in FighterZ is, I'm not saying that, but, like, it's such a different character type. You can just feel, like, the joy emanating from the character design of, like, we get to do something really different with Videl. And I agree about the ending animation. I tweeted it out earlier, because they have a great line where if you beat Kid Buu, she says in Japanese Majin Buu, she's like, oh my god, I beat Majin Buu. And it's just so funny. And I love it. And I want to put her up against, like, Cell and Frieza and everyone now.
Yeah. Also, one last thing on Videl. I love so much. I forget what, I think it's if you press forward in key attack or something, like whatever button combination does, Gohan popping out as Great Saiyaman.
I know what you're going to say.
Throwing a key blast. And if he hits with the ki blast, Masako Nozawa goes, Stonaika! And then does this cool pose, and it's fucking amazing. Like, it's an attack that is, it's a very slow moving projectile, so I'm not very good at using it, but I use it all the time just because I constantly want that fucking animation and audio file to play.
That's great, but I also love when Great Saiyaman is out doing his thing, Videl is in the back going like, she's like shadow boxing, like punch, punch, and it's just mm-hmm. the cutest little animation. I love it.
Yeah, there's so many little animation details with those two. And it's, yeah, they took what are like the two probably most joyous characters in Dragon Ball, Great Saiyaman and Videl, and like that is fully communicated with basically everything they did with their implementation of the game. So yeah, if you're someone on the fence with these two characters, I think if you're someone that likes to play Dragon Ball Fighters, it is well worth picking these up because they're fucking awesome.
Fucking awesome. We know we're getting Gogeta and we're getting Movie Broly. Do you still think Kefla and Ultra Instinct Goku are the last two?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty strong bet. Like, yeah. The only, like, I think there's a chance no Ultra Instinct Goku because there are a lot of Gokus in the game. I still think it's going to be Ultra Instinct Goku, and people are going to bitch about it and then be very happy when they see Ultra Instinct Goku the same way they were with Base Goku because it's like, oh shit, that's right. Goku's fucking cool, and there's a lot of shit you can do with another Goku.
I think they need to add two Gokus, Sean, so that we can have a match where it's three Gokus versus three Gokus, and they're all different. Because right now we have four. When we have Goku Base, Super Saiyan God. We have Goku Black. We need Ultra Instinct Goku, and then we need like Kid Goku or something, so we can just have a full 3-on-3 Goku match.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, and then eventually, you know, 2 or 3 years from now when they're like, okay, fuck, I guess we have to add GT characters. We can get Super Saiyan 4 Goku. We can get, like, Kid Goku from Dragon Ball GT, which will be a different Kid Goku from Kid Goku from original Dragon Ball. And so we'll be able to have, like, 5 teams of Gokus at some point, and I will be fucking thrilled about it.
Absolutely. I mean, Goku is, like, one of the most venerable characters in the history of anime. If anyone deserves 5 separate incarnations in a fighting game, it's Goku. Like, it's okay. There's a lot of Gokus. If there were like 5 Tenshinhans or something, I'd be questioning that. But they haven't done that yet.
You know, I could go with another Tenshinhan. I'd be cool with we have 2 Tenshinhans.
The evil Tenshinhan from like the very beginning of the series. I thought
you were going to say from like Garlic Jr. possesses Tenshinhan from Dragon Ball Z.
No, that's before we get that, we need Mr. Popo, and then we need evil Mr. Popo from that arc. I don't remember if Mr. Popo gets evil in that.
Everybody does. Yeah. You know, we'll get evil Red Eye Bulma, and she'll just be crazy.
All right. So, do you want to hit Anthem first? Do you want to hit Destiny first?
I feel like we're going to end up talking about both of them at the same time, no matter which one we talk about first.
Let's start with Destiny, and we'll make this quick, because I don't know if we have a ton more to say. So, I beat Forsaken, the main campaign, and then I realized, oh good God, there's way more to do in this expansion than I thought.
Yeah, so by beating the Forsaken campaign, you mean you put down the first, what the fuck's the queen's brother?
Yeah,
that guy.
I shot that motherfucker in the head.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's that, and then there's like another thing where you go to the Dreaming City. So it's like I'm not sure. So that's something you haven't gotten to yet.
Okay.
So there's a couple of more like campaign missions that are more like open-ended because of stuff that sets up the area where the raid is and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
That's also, the Dreaming City's fucking awesome. You'll love it when you get there.
Well,
I wasn't sure if you had gotten there yet or not.
I mean, I've done a strike in the Dreaming City, and I've done obviously the campaign mission there that's at the end of the game. Is this the quest line that I'm doing where I have to go find all the like hidden areas and stuff?
Yes, I think so.
Then I'm well on my way for that, yes. I've also played some Gambit. I've been doing some of the different dailies. I love how many different daily and weekly activities there are. It's almost overwhelming, but, like, they've given you lots and lots and lots of stuff to do. I've played a little bit of Crucible. I have, you know, mixed feelings on some parts. Overall, I'm very positive on it. I think the campaign is fantastic. It's not necessarily my favorite Destiny campaign, because I still think the one that shipped with Destiny 2, the Red War, is really great, and it is like the fullest Destiny campaign they've ever done. But the Forsaken one is really different. It's very focused. It's tight. I played most of it in one day, and I loved the hell out of it. I think the last mission in Forsaken the main campaign is the best mission in Destiny that they've ever done. It's amazing. And the stuff in the like palace you end up in at the end, and the switching between the Ascendant plane and that palace, that is the most impressive visual work I've seen on this generation of consoles. Full stop. I have not seen anything that made my jaw drop harder than all of that. It looks like if Bungie made a fucking Castlevania game, and I goddamn love it.
Yes, absolutely. It's everything they do with, like, the Taken and shifting in those portals. Like, there's that one, I don't know if you've done that strike, but there's a strike where you go in between.
Yep, that's so good.
Yeah, it's just like, that shit is so impressive to me. It's one of those things where it's like, holy shit, like, I can't believe that they're able to do this, because it just feels like you're shifting so seamlessly from one set of geometry to another, and, like, this completely different art style. It's awesome.
Well, and just, like, that palace at the end that you're in, the watchtower, whatever it's called, and the architecture and the colors and, like, the, you know, I don't have an HDR TV. I can only imagine what it looks like on yours, Sean, but on my measly 1080p display, it still was, like, the richest use of color I've seen this generation. Like, the variety of purples in that space, and, like, the big, like, stained glass windows. I really do. I'm serious. It looks like Bungie's take on Castlevania. Like, if Bungie did a Symphony of the Night remake, this is the castle they would come up with. This, like, cathedral space. It is so amazing. I love, so the campaign is great. I've played most of the new strikes, and I've been catching up on a lot of the strikes they added in the other DLCs. And I have to say, the strikes in base Destiny 2 were the thing I criticized the most at the time, because I thought they were a little short, they were a little lacking in substance, I found them kind of dull. The new strikes are fucking great. Like, all the ones for Forsaken in particular are fantastic, but the ones they added in the in-between DLCs are really good too. So I was happy to see those. There's some really good ones in all
of
that.
Have you played the strike where you go back to the Prison of Elders?
When
I realized we were in that area from Prison of Elders, where, like, you're disabling the mines and everything, like, I was like, oh my god, I can't believe
I had the biggest smile on my face.
Yeah, it's such a smart use of, like, the nostalgia I have for Destiny 1, and it was something that, like, it ended up making me feel slightly bummed that, you know, Destiny 2 doesn't have the Hitman 2 thing of, I can just go and do all the Destiny 1 stuff in Destiny 2. I'm sure, you know, I'm not saying that that's something that Bungie absolutely needs to do, because I'm sure it's a fucking massive technical hurdle to try to do something like that. But it was one of the things that kind of bummed me out. It's like, man, I wish I could just go play the Prison of Elders, in, like, a weird time warp thing. And it's like, oh, let's be the Prison of Elders and let's run around fucking Russia and the moon and stuff. Like, it made me really nostalgic for Destiny 1 in a way that I didn't realize I would be, because it's been 5 years since Destiny 1 launched.
So it's like, and it's one of the only times Destiny 2 has done a direct, like, they've done callbacks, but a direct, like, play on your nostalgia in that way, and it's really effective. Yeah. So the strikes are great, the campaign is great, all of the overhauls I think they've done to the UI and the gameplay systems are really effective. I think all the things they've added with dailies and just the sheer number of quests. Like, my fucking inventory, I'm fucking new to this version of the game, and I have 30 fucking quests. So, like, I have plenty to do if I want to just go do shit in Destiny. So that's great. And I guess that leaves Crucible and Gambit. And I will say, So Crucible, there's no fucking reason to play that anymore, because I go into Crucible and I can't get any kills, and every time I go out on the field, I just get shot from 50 miles away, and I don't see the person who did it, and I don't know how it happened, and it happened immediately, and I don't know if, like, it's just that other people are really good, or if they've, like, really, like, ramped up the time to death and it's really fast, but there's something about Crucible where I liked it in base Destiny 2, and basically it's unplayable to me now.
Yeah, it feels just to me like it's that thing of, you know, we have been out of Destiny 2 for, like, a year, and there are people that did not take that year off, and those are the people that are still, like, obsessively playing Destiny 2 Crucible and are, like, at light level 650 or whatever.
Yeah.
It's a lot of that. And so sometimes I found most success playing Free For All, actually, because I feel like it kind of feels like the highest level skill players are in the other modes, and so in Free For All, I can kind of do some good shit. But yeah,
it bumps me out.
I'm having a much harder time with it this time around than I was at the launch of Destiny 2, for sure.
Because I've always been pretty good at Crucible. Like, you can actually, this is the one FPS I will ever claim to have been genuinely good at. Like, you can ask my brother, because he's played a lot online with me. I usually am, like, the top player on my team or less, and I'm not. And I was like, fuck, I really don't know how this is played anymore. And some of that is just, like, getting used to the new weapons and balancing and stuff. But it did bum me out, because you get a quest to get Cade's hand cannon. Mm-hmm. And, Look, hand cannons are the worst weapons in Destiny 2. They fucking suck. I hate them. They should be banished from the earth. But
I couldn't disagree more. Hand cannons are fucking rad.
I hate the hand cannons. So but the way this quest goes is the first thing you have to do is go use hand cannons in Gambit. So I did that, even though I hate hand cannons and I'm not good at them. I got all the kills with the hand cannons in Gambit. Then it says go use your hand cannons in Strike. So I did that. Now it's go get 25 precision kills with hand cannons in Crucible. I'm like, that'll never happen. I will never be able to do that in my lifetime. So I will never see K's hand cannon.
I think I have 18 out of 25. I haven't played much Crucible. So it's like, because I've only played enough Crucible to get the daily and weekly. So it's like, once I get that, I'm kind of like, I'm good. Like, I have fun while I'm doing it, but I do not, unlike Gambit, I have no urge to keep on playing it past the, like, basic, very easy to get powerful gear stuff. Whereas with Gambit, I'm going into, like, completing the weekly bounties and the stuff that takes a little bit longer, but you still get rewards for.
Yeah. So speaking of Gambit, I really like Gambit. I like it in theory a lot, and I think it's a really cool mode. It's got great maps. I was surprised by how many maps there are to play Gambit on. Mm-hmm. They're really unique. It is a very fun mode to play. My one problem is the same thing with Crucible, where I have run into balance issues where there's a... And this happened, like, all weekend to me. Like, I had a better couple of days on, like, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday with Gambit, and then... Saturday and Sunday, like, I have not even come within the range of winning a game, because it's like, there are people who just have that mode down to such a science, where you go in and, like, we're still cleaning up, like, in the mid-range of, like, how many motes you need, and they have their thing on the field, and then, like, once their thing is on the field, they defeat it in, like, 30 seconds. And I've just run into that so many times that it's gotten a little frustrating. Like, I don't know if it's just bad luck, or if, like, there's a lot of people who are just really fucking good at Gambit. But it is a really cool mode. It's really creative. It's the most Bungie has... It's the most it feels like Bungie has, like, really put passion into a PvP mode in Destiny so far. Like we said last week, it really does feel more like one of the modes from Halo, particularly late-era Halo, like 3 and Reach, than it does sort of the Destiny PvP modes, which are pretty... Like, they're not bad, but they're just kind of standard PvP modes. It's a really cool idea. I almost wish there was a clear way to, like, divide power levels or something in it, because sometimes it's just, like, there was one today where, like, I would try to go invade the enemy space, and I would, like, get through the portal and get shot in the head and just out. And I'm like, I don't even know how that happens, because you're supposed to have, like, so much shielding, and when we get an invader, like, three of us together can't fucking kill them, and I'm just like, poof, and I'm like, I don't know what's going on here anymore. So sometimes that can be a little frustrating, but it is a really cool mode.
Yeah, Gambit continues to be the most fun I'm having with the game. Like, I think even when I lose, I'm having a lot of fun. I think part of it is, like, I feel like I'm really good at Gambit, so it's like I'm almost always top, or like top one or two players in the whole match. Because I think it's just like, it's finally, because it's the thing with Crucible, I never played enough Crucible in, like, regularly to get good at it. Because I just kind of got frustrated with, like, the supers and stuff. Just never felt quite balanced to me in a way I enjoyed. But I have played a shit ton. I've done a lot of shooting things in the face in Destiny that are not other human players.
Yeah.
So it has leveraged the hundreds of hours I've spent just fucking blowing up Cabal and Hive and just murdering the shit out of stuff. And there's something that's really so tremendously satisfying about being able to take that skill and apply it in a competitive setting, that when I do really well in a Gambit game, I get this just, like, total high of fucking, I'm murdering shit like crazy and picking up all these motes. And when you dump 15 motes at a time and you send over a large blocker and the Gambit dude, the Drifter, that I just love the Drifter. I think he's a great character. And he's just like, you send over a large blocker. He's like a mini Oryx. Good going. I'm like, yeah, fucking dunk on those motherfuckers. Like, deal with that shit. Because I know how annoying it is when you're about to fucking slam some motes in and all of a sudden the bank goes away and a giant ogre just appears. I love that mode so much. I think the presentation around that mode is also fantastic. Like, when the Drifter pops in and he's like, let's see who you're fighting today. It's the Cabal. And then you load into the thing.
It's really,
like,
great, yeah.
The two teams stare at each other across this, like, glass window, and you're doing your emotes, and I unlock this good emote from a Bright Ingram that is just, like, I put down this, like ethereal chair and spin it around and sit on it backwards, like I'm going to, like, talk to the kids, like, it's real talk time.
You're doing the Riker. Kids. That's Commander Riker,
yeah,
from
exactly,
Star Trek.
Like, the Riker move, or, like, I'm about to have a talk with you about, like, why drugs are no good. And I just do that animation and, like, stare at the other team while they're dancing and shit. And it feels... I just have so much fun. every time I load into Gambit, even when I'm losing, I'm having a blast because I usually get to do at least some cool stuff because when you're playing Crucible and you get just totally shut down all the time, you do nothing. Like, you get no kills, you're constantly dead. At least in Gambit, even if you're getting, your team is getting shut down, I'm still blowing shit up.
I'm still getting emotes.
Like, I'm still contributing in a way that feels more real to me than if my team is getting shut down in Crucible.
It's really fun. I love all the bounties around it. It gives you a lot to think about and do while you're in the matches. So, yeah, I agree with all that. It's a really cool mode. There's, I think both in it and Crucible, I wish there was some balancing things that could be done. But overall, really good stuff, and I'm glad it's in there. And also, just to mention, the soundtrack in Forsaken is so fucking good. It was great in the base game. Like, Destiny has become one of the best games for music, and like, I bought the Forsaken soundtrack, and it's just, there's some incredible tracks on there, and as I'm playing, I'm just enjoying more of the music I get to hear. It's really neat stuff, and, you know, I feel like Destiny is in as good a place as it's ever been. It has so much personality. It has the tightest gameplay of any FPS pretty much ever. It's just really great, and it feels like it has found itself. Mm-hmm. And then we played Anthem this weekend.
Uh-huh.
Sean, you want to take a trip on down to Sean's Beta Corner?
It's time to go take a trip, and we'll have fun in my Beta Corner. I'm Sean.
And I'm Jonathan.
Yeah, so this is going to be an extended segment. Well, I'm Sean Chapman. Welcome to my Beta Corner, where we take a look at the latest and greatest in the hot world of video game betas. This week on the show, I'm happy to invite a special guest, Mr. Jonathan Lack, while we talk about the beta for EA and BioWare's new hot late release Anthem, which has been in works for a while. We got to see it, I think it was last year at E3, or 2 years ago at E3, because it's, you know, we just got it in 2019. So E3 2017, we got a peek at Anthem. They had a really good demo, that big meaty demo that was like 6 minutes long that looked way better than what I saw in this fucking beta. And then last year, we got another little tease that just felt like, I don't know how you guys don't know how you're selling this game. And so now, yeah, we have a full little network beta here that is basically the same kind of content, from what I understand, as the VIP beta was last weekend. It's basically three story missions that are all tied together but kind of exist in some weird void. There's no real tutorialization. There's no onboarding at all. You just kind of load into the game and play what I assume are three early missions in the game but are clearly not, like, the first three missions. There's a, like, free roam mode you can go into, and there's some sort of stronghold thing that, what from what I understand, is basically a strike in Destiny, but I could never get that to work.
That's because everything in this game has a clear analog to Destiny, because it's a Destiny clone. We'll talk about that later.
Yes, but that's basically the content in the beta. It's very, like, a very light amount of content. You start off with the Ranger suit. So Anthem, all the characters are in javelin, what are called javelins, which are basically mech, like, exosuit looking things. And you start with the Ranger suit. When you beat the three campaign missions in the demo, you get to pick one of the other three for, like, the total four javelins, at least that are in the beta. I don't know how many are going to be in the full game. I suspect it's probably just these four. And all three of those other ones seem way more interesting than the Ranger. So I did pick the Storm one and played around a little bit with that. It seemed kind of fun, but I had already played the demo by that point. As I said, I couldn't get the other thing, the Stronghold thing, to even work because it just wouldn't load. That's basically the content that was in the beta. The game is third-person Destiny. The game is third-person Destiny. Basically.
I want to, because this is what surprised me most. It's Destiny. Like, it is not. Mm-hmm. It is not Destiny-esque. It's not BioWare's. It's Destiny. Like, it is Destiny in third person with less interesting environments and less compelling combat and no music, because it is an eerily silent game, and that freaked me the fuck out the entire time I was playing it. And, like, everything you know about Destiny, there is a clear analog to it here. Like, you could just get your fucking thesaurus out and, like, you know, okay, Guardians in Destiny, what are they called here? They're the Freelancers. The Drops in Destiny, what are they called here? Those are your resources that you go and pick up, and there's flowers, and you press the square button to get the flowers, and you get the little resources in there. And it's like, it's Destiny with no personality, No recognizable story or plot or anything like that. Like I said, no music or sound design, which we'll talk about that later. It's the weirdest part of the entire demo to me. The combat is like, eh, but it's there's nothing really special about it. It's the only, like, notably original thing that I saw here is that you can fly, and that's kind of fun. But it's, like, were you surprised at how much it is, it's Destiny?
It was 100% the amount of Destiny that I kind of thought this game was going to be. Like, it just seemed like, maybe it was because I looked at a little bit more stuff than you did over the past couple of months.
I've looked at nothing, like, so yeah.
Yeah, because I had kind of followed some of the public opinion around the VIP beta last week. So that's probably one of the reasons why I wasn't particularly surprised at how Destiny-y it is. You know, because it is down to, like, I mean, the control scheme, broadly speaking, is very Destiny. Like, of, you know, you have two abilities on R1 and L1, and then you have your super. I mean, you get, like, another, like, team, like, shield kind of thing you can do, which is kind of weird. One of the big problems with this beta is that it just doesn't explain fucking jack shit to you. So basically, it's this weird situation where everything that was 100% like Destiny, I understood immediately what was going on. Anything that veered from it a little bit, I was kind of confused because the game takes at least this beta takes no pains to introduce any of these concepts.
It's also got
the UI is fucking terrible.
The UI is terrible. It is convoluted. It is hard to figure out. Like, it took me forever to figure out how to launch a mission because what you have to do is, like, say, it says, like, press square to start. I'm like, I press square and I'm like, you haven't selected anything. I'm like, okay. So I go into the map and I'm like, I want to play this campaign mission. And I press X and nothing happens. And I press X and nothing happens. And I press X and nothing happens. So finally I say, okay, circle or something will give me quick play. So I do quick play. Nothing happens. I do quick play. Nothing happens. I'm like, well, what the fuck's going on? And then finally I just back out of the menu and then it says, good, you've selected a mission. Now you can start. And I'm like, who the fuck designs their thing this way? It's the weirdest thing. And yes, the entire UI, like, say what you will about Destiny's evolution over the years, Destiny has always been a very slick and easy to understand game in terms of the basics of, like, how do I go somewhere? Or how do I pick a gun? Like, it's not been easy to understand in terms of some of the lore and things like that, but in those basics it's been easy to understand. This is not.
So I think with Anthem, it seems very clear that both of us had a less than stellar experience with this beta so far. And I think it's important to, like, I feel like the story of Anthem, the Anthem beta, is there are two levels of things going on here. One is that Anthem as a game, even though I've only played like 2 to 3 hours of this beta, I feel very confident saying there are some big issues with, like, their execution on a lot of elements in the game. That is bad in this beta, and is going to be bad when you play the full game when it comes out, right? But then there's another level of things of, this is just, like, a classically terrible beta for a fucking video game. Or demo. Like not necessarily, like, the technical issues even aside, which I've had, you know, I don't think I had the worst technical issues. I got through the 3 campaign missions and all that stuff fine. It was only when, like, the day after, because I did all that on the first day it was available. Then yesterday, I guess, was when I tried to play the Stronghold and just couldn't get it to work. And I didn't even honestly try today, which is Sunday as we're recording this. So there's, like, the technical issues with it. But when I say it's, like, a classically bad beta, I more mean just the slice of game they've given to us, I feel like, is really bad and feels like it shows off the game in its worst elements. And if they had maybe started you with a slightly higher level character, added in a tutorial mission near the beginning or something very light to tutorialize new players, and then gave us a slightly more diverse selection of content, assuming hopefully there's a slightly more diverse selection of content to pull from the game. So that's contingent on that. But giving us, like, something like a slightly different look at the game, because one of the major issues with Anthem and this beta is that shooting the guns is incredibly fucking boring. I just found the basic combat utterly dull for, like, the entirety of those 3 campaign missions. But then part of the thing that was very frustrating is that I unlocked the Storm Javelin at the end of those 3 missions, and I didn't get a lot of time to play with it because of the aforementioned technical issues with the network stuff. But the little bit I did play with was immediately about 3 times as more interesting to me as the Ranger thing they start you with, because the Ranger is basically the soldier class from Mass Effect in that it goes around and shoots guns, and you have a grenade, and you have a, like, little tiny missile you shoot, and then his super is that he shoots a lot more missiles, and it's the most boring fucking thing in the world. It's like, I don't want to pick a class who's one of their, like, two special abilities they have that you're using through combat is a buck-fucking-standard frag grenade. Like, it's, you know, in Destiny you have grenade specials, but the grenade specials I use are, like, a grenade that sticks to the wall and shoots giant spikes all over the place, or one that summons a, like, wall of purple hellfire that spreads across the ground, or one that blows up into a million other grenades that heat-seek the enemy. You know, all the grenades in Destiny are interesting different kinds of grenades. The grenade you get as the Ranger in Anthem is the fucking grenade you get when you fucking start up a normal multiplayer match in Call of Duty. It's just plain, boring, nothing, fuck you, grenade. It's just so fucking dull.
It's mind-numbing. Like, I'm amazed you got through all three campaign missions. I sure as fuck didn't. Like, because that first one took me a full hour to get through because it kept, for one, the game just loads everywhere. We'll talk about that later. The crew I was with, like, none of us knew what we were doing. The game is really bad at telling you where to go and what to do. We kept wiping because the difficulty is, like, in weird fits and starts. This shooting is, like, I feel brain cells dying. Like, it is the dullest, like, it's competent. Like, it's not that it, like, plays poorly. It's just dull beyond words. And, yeah, maybe there is something more interesting, but I don't know if I care to find out after playing this. My favorite example, though, Sean, of this being a bad demo, is that where they start you in the tower for Destiny. I don't know what they call it here. The city, yeah. Whatever.
Tarsus, I think, is what it's called.
Fort Tarsus or whatever. So they start you there, and they start you, and you're looking at, like, a group of people over here. And I'm like, okay, I want to go see what these people are up to. And you go walk over to the people, and it says, press X to talk. And you press X to talk, and it says, this content is not available in the demo. That is the most...
Oh, I didn't see
you
that.
You didn't see that? The first people you can talk to in this game, it doesn't let you talk to. That is the most baffling beta decision I've ever seen. Especially for a game where the main, like... worry among fans is that this game has no story, which is what BioWare is known for, is that I'm like, okay, I want to go talk to these NPCs, and they've taken that out of the demo. It's like, I don't mind that content's not in there. I just wish they didn't, like, dangle the fucking, like, keys in front of my face and be like, you want story? No, you can't have it. This game bored me to absolute tears. You know, it looks nice. The flying is kind of fun. But other than that, like... It's so dull. It's just so dull. Yeah. There's nothing to this game. Because even best case scenario, if this was like a really good Destiny clone, I don't need a Destiny clone because I have Destiny. I've been playing Destiny for 5 years on and off. And it's great and it's fine and it's had time to find itself. And it is also in a tremendous time suck. And I in no way need two Destinies in my life. This is not good Destiny. This isn't even like... we have been following Destiny, Sean, since, like, literally the beginning. Like, with the alpha thing they had for PS4, remember? Yeah. And we were hooked right off the bat because there was, you know, that alpha also did not do a lot to tutorialize or explain. But you got to go shoot stuff, and it's really fun. And Destiny, it looked great, and it sounded great, and it played great. And so it hooked you. This is, like, that's what I'm comparing this to with Anthem. And that was, like, months out from release for Destiny. This is days out from release for Anthem. And this is still, like, it's technically broken in a ton of ways. It is dull to play. This is, like, worst, whatever the polar opposite of putting your best foot forward is, that's what this demo is. And I was kind of shocked how dull it was.
Yeah, because I think you make a good point that, like, when we're comparing this to Destiny, like, I'm not saying, like, I'm not comparing it to Destiny 2 Forsaken.
No.
Like, directly. I'm not saying that this needs to be that. But yes, both of us, if we've talked about this on a podcast 5 years ago or whatever, we both of us got into the alpha for Destiny 1. We both of us got into the beta they did later for Destiny 1. And as you said, the alpha for Destiny 1 came out, like, 3 or 4 months before. Like, it was the summer before the
game launched.
It was
an E3 drop. It was, like, that fun, like, we're going to have a fun demo thing. And that's what they did. And it was at Sony's E3 presentation. They gave out codes.
Yeah, and it's a testament to the slickness of Destiny's presentation that they did not tutorialize you in that alpha any more than this beta tutorializes you for Anthem, but I never found that beta or alpha for Destiny confusing. Because it was like, nope, like, it's very clear. When you pick up a weapon and you press start, you go into your fucking inventory screen, and the new weapon you picked up is, like, shining in the slot that it's in, and you go and scroll over it, and the number's higher. And it's like, all of that UI presentation stuff in Destiny, like, say what you will about like some of the confusing stuff when you got to the end game, particularly for Destiny 1, of like the strange coins and all that. Like all that bullshit was confusing as fuck. But the core game, and especially what you're presented to in that alpha of like three or four missions on Russia, Earth, that was like most of the missions on Earth, which is one of the problems we later found out when the game came out, was like, oh, you basically played through the entire Earth section of that game in the alpha and beta. That was not clear at the time. But, you know, that core basic experience was very clear and slickly presented to the player. Anthem, it's the exact opposite. And so one of the things that's really frustrating is that when I got to the end of those three missions and started playing as a Storm, I could kind of started to see, oh, there's something here with the combat where the combat in Anthem feels much more reliant on the powers than Destiny's does. Because the powers in Anthem have a very short cooldown. Like, it's a couple of seconds, and you can throw a grenade again, or launch a lightning attack or whatever with the Storm Javelin, which is kind of like a mage analog kind of class. And those powers, you're meant to use them constantly, and they chain together with other team members that are using their powers, and that's how you get high damage. Like, that, theoretically, seems to be what the combat model is in Anthem. And when I engaged with that a little bit, I was like, okay, this seems fine. Like, this seems like I could see myself playing a lot more of that game at some point. But that's not the game you play for most of the beta. Because for most of the beta, you're playing as the Ranger. And the Ranger, most of his damage model feels it's based around you shooting a gun. And the gunplay in Anthem is slow. It's clunky. They do something that is, for me, like a classic fucking mistake for third-person shooters, which is when you reload a gun, a fucking graphic pops up on the screen that says reloading, and like a little thing fills up like it's a progress bar that's just this very consistent bar that fills up while you reload. That makes reloading feel like this dull, like clerical task you must perform. As opposed to in Destiny, when you reload, it's you get this nice, satisfying, really dynamic animation with all these clicks and clacks, and it's like, it's not just this, I'm reloading, let me play this animation at like this uniform speed as this bar fills up, and I'm staring at this bar waiting for the thing to fill up, so I've done reloading, so I can shoot my machine gun again, which is what Anthem does. And so much of Anthem just feels like a very just like, fucking like meat and potatoes, like here I have a machine gun, I hold down the trigger and go pop 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 and shoot the enemy, and little button their numbers pop out, and then I've bop 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 long enough that I have to reload, and so it goes click, and then the bar comes up and fills, and then the bar's done and it clicks again, it's like bop 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 bop, and that's what you're doing for the whole fucking game in terms of the combat. It's like, even it is that, because that default machine gun they give you for that first mission, like, literally fires at that pace. It's literally
I'm laughing because this is so true. Because this is like, I feel like this is like if you gave someone the truth serum on stage at E3 while they're presenting the demo, that's what they'd be doing, Sean. They'd be going like, and here's Anthem, you go bup 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 bup, reloading. Bup 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 bup, isn't this fun, kids? Aren't you having fun? Because that is what it feels like when you're playing.
It is just so fucking boring. And one of the few things that Anthem has that it does well, like, you know, it has those powers thing that the Storm seems like it has cool powers. Like, I am assuming that when you level up the Ranger thing, you have to get something more interesting. I'll have enough faith in BioWare that at the end game, your grenades will do cool shit when you're playing as the Ranger, but they don't do anything cool when you're playing it in this beta, which is part of that, like, it's a terrible beta problem.
Like, it's down to the grenades have the same animation arc on them, like, the thing that, like, maps out where it's going to go, as Mass Effect 1 and Gears of War did. Like, it's, even the presentation is just, like, old as shit.
Yeah, and it's just the sound effects are not particularly great. One of the issues is that the enemies have, like, what feels like no hit reacts at all. So while you shoot them, it doesn't feel like they're, you know, when you shoot an enemy in Destiny, particularly with, like, a shotgun or a hand cannon or something that's, like, a really powerful, slow-firing weapon, the enemy, like, flinches and flies back. Like, even if it's a big enemy and you shoot them with a sniper rifle and they're, like, weak point, they'll flinch and, like, stop attacking and stuff. In Anthem, it just never felt like enemies responded to your attacks. And you're just walking around and bopping them with it, with that fucking assault rifle. And one of the other good things that Anthem has that I think there's potential there when you get better at the game is some of the mobility stuff. And I think, like, the flying feels good and cool. You can, like, I never got quite good at it because I think it's kind of awkward how you enter it and exit it, but you can get into this, like, hover mode where while you're flying, I think, if you aim, you shift into a hover mode. It's not quite smooth enough because I think there's a little bit of an input lag, a little bit more of an input lag than you would want on a game like this in Anthem, at least in this beta. Maybe that is something they theoretically could have shaved down a little bit for the launch game. But yeah, you can kind of hover around and pop enemies while hovering, which is another thing that like the Storm Javelin can hover for a lot longer than the other ones. So it's like some of that mobility stuff does feel good and it differentiates itself a little bit from Destiny. But at least early on playing this beta, I never got a good sense of being able to use that mobility in the middle of fighting that well. And part of it, it feels like the Ranger suit is not designed to do that much, which is another thing that like Destiny, while you don't have anything quite as extravagant as like the full-on Iron Man style flying in Anthem, like you are a very mobile character. You have like double jumps and stuff and you're moving around the environment and taking cover and you feel very active and dynamic and involved in the combat. And Anthem, when my team was fighting like a really powerful enemy, it felt like most of the time the best thing to do was to kind of hover there, go bup, 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 and throw grenades every 3 seconds as the cooldown went down. And it was just like, well, I'm just hovering here and he's not shooting me, so I'm fine. And Destiny, even in the beta, was never, slash alpha, like, it was never that static. It was never that stale. Like, no matter what you're doing, you're constantly moving around. And if you ever, in Destiny, get, like, a full, solid, like, 2 to 3 seconds to be able to stand in one spot and shoot the boss, you're like, thank God. Yep. Like, I can just stand here and just lay into this boss, because most of the time I'm dealing with these fucking, like, guys that are running up and exploding, and there's snipers up on that cliff, and you're like, you know, your fire team is dealing with so much stuff in one encounter. That if you ever got time to just lay into the boss, it was like, okay, while we're laying into this boss, we're going to take out like half its fucking health. And Anthem, it just was like, nope, like you're constantly just hovering there, putting damage into the boss enemy and the fucking bar. Like if you think Destiny has issues with bullet spongy enemies,
oh my
fucking
God.
Anthem, it's on another fucking
it's
level.
Like if it's
that bar's moving down so slowly.
Like Destiny has bullet spongy bosses. It never had bullet spongy pawns. Like this is like if the dregs, the literal enemies called dregs in Destiny, were bullet sponges instead of like one hit kills to the head, you know. This is like if the grunts in Halo were bullet spongy, which means the end of, like the bosses are really bullet spongy. I think we need a better word than sponge, because yes, like the base enemies just take for fucking ever. I also found a lot of, Sean, and I don't know if you encountered this, I could just I wasn't on like chat, I could feel other players getting frustrated, like, and not knowing what to do, and, like, getting lost, and people dropping out, and new people coming in, and, like, I did try to run the stronghold, and for one, like, I would have had to be a higher level, because it was just all, like, we were just getting slaughtered, but it was like, you know, we all went in, we were kind of lost, we went in, we all got fucking killed, most everyone dropped out, we tried it again, we couldn't do it, everyone else dropped out but me, I tried to, like, fly around the enemies, I couldn't do that, and then I dropped out. It was like, you could just feel people getting frustrated with it and bored. And I...
Yeah, there's one of the campaign missions where you fight a boss enemy, like, on top of this plateau, and it had that feeling of it, of like, yeah, people are getting annoyed because it feels like we're getting killed, and it's unclear why, because one of the things is that the game, another issue with the UI is that the game is very bad at, like, giving you information about, like, what you're doing wrong and what you're getting hit from, because there's this one boss enemy that was shooting an attack at me that was staggering me, but I never knew when he was targeting me, and it was never clear when he fired the weapon. And so it's like I was just getting staggered out of nowhere, and I didn't even realize where the enemy was hitting me from. I had no idea that it was getting ready to shoot this attack that staggers you, and that's part of the thing that frustrated me and felt like it was frustrating other people I was playing with, was it was just bad at communicating basic like gameplay information to the player on a moment-to-moment basis, which is a different issue than being able to communicate gameplay information on like a larger structural sense of like how you pick missions and all that kind of stuff that the game is also very bad
at. Screen is horrifically cluttered. Like that's one thing I noticed throughout, is that like Destiny does not have the most uncluttered screen, but like if let's make a scale here, Sean, I would say there's a scale from, like, Red Dead Redemption 2 to Assassin's Creed Odyssey, if we want to go there, okay, of, like, mass screen clutter, which is what everything I've... All the Assassin's Creed games are like that, but I saw some screenshots of Odyssey that just made my heart stop. They were so cluttered. And Red Dead 2 that has almost no on-screen UI elements, Destiny 2 is like, or Destiny is somewhere in the middle. It's got, you know, some indicators and stuff, but it's pretty uncluttered for the kind of game it is, right?
Yes.
And being an FPS helps. This game is more on the Assassin's Creed Odyssey end of things. It is mass clutter everywhere. I'm not sure it being third person is a good choice, I honestly felt. Like it, and maybe it's just because I was jumping back and forth between this and Destiny, but it felt like a lot of the, at least for the Ranger, a lot of the shooting mechanics felt like they wanted to be a first person thing because they are ripped so out of a Destiny or something. And yet they're in third person. It didn't feel natural. The only time the third person stuff felt natural to me was when I was flying around, because I don't know how else you would do that. But, like, it just added to this overall sense of clutter and that I'm not sure where I am in the world. And, like, I don't think this kind of third-person combat is suited to this kind of game in the best of circumstances, but this isn't nearly revolutionary enough to overcome that hurdle. I don't know.
Yeah.
But here,
One of the issues with the screen clutter is also that, you know, the first mission I was playing, it took me an embarrassingly long amount of time. And, you know, I'm someone who's been playing fucking video games literally my entire life. Like, I should not be having this problem. It took me forever to figure out that there was an objective indicator on my screen.
Yeah, no, me too.
I had no idea where to go. Because all the indicators on screen look the fucking same. Because they're all, like, kind of like blue circles. And they're all about the same size. I think the objective indicator has, like, a white outline or something, or it's a slightly different shape. But it's broadly speaking, like, when you glance at it, it looks like a blue circle, which is the same indicator that they use to show you where your teammates are, and you have, like, three other teammates, and I'm not even sure if you can play solo. I didn't figure out if there was a way to play solo. It just seemed like it just constantly matchmaking me with randos, even though I wanted to play the game solo, but it doesn't feel like it's built to be that way at all, because that's how I play most Destiny stuff, is I like to play on my own and then sometimes play with other people. But so you have three blue circles on the screen, at least three, that indicate where your teammates are. That is almost always going to be somewhere on the edge of the screen, because you're not looking at your teammates, because they're flying all the fuck all over the place, because they have no idea where the fuck they're going. And one of those blue circles on the edge of the screen is a fourth blue circle that looks slightly different. That is where your objective is. So I just had, for the longest time, I thought, oh, there's no objective indicator. I'd have, like, four teammates. And we're all just flying around like idiots, not knowing where to go, until I realized, oh no, one of those is actually the objective indicator, and I can follow that, and it's pointing me where I need to go, like the little white dot does in Destiny. But in Destiny, the white dot is the dot that shows you where the fucking goal is. The other indicators on screen are not little white dots.
Yeah, there usually are no other dots. Like, that's, it's so weird. Yeah, no, I had that where, like, it took us forever to get through that first mission because it's just sending you all over the place. And I couldn't figure it out. My teammates couldn't figure it out. It's like a bunch of fucking mice in a maze. It's so bad. I have two major questions, Sean.
Okay.
Unrelated to some of these things. One, why is there no sound design other than gunplay? We'll get to that. Where'd the sound go? It's eerie. And I thought something was broken with my TV and I checked my speakers, but no. And second, is this the first game of this generation to have major loading screens within an open world?
Yes. I'm glad you brought both of those up, because those are definitely two points I want to hit. The loading screen one first.
What the fuck?
Yeah. So I had heard, again, because I kind of followed some of the scuttlebutt around the demo, the VIP one from last week for people who pre-ordered. I had heard there was something weird with loading, but I had thought that that meant, like, oh, the load times are long. Which is a problem that Destiny has. Like, on consoles, Destiny has long
all
load
consoles.
Times.
Like, that's actually the biggest thing I want out of next-gen consoles, is better load times. Because it's become a big problem this generation.
What we're going to get next console generation is the same thing we get every console generation, where it starts with really good load times, and then the games get really complicated and the load times get longer. It's just how that fucking shit works. But Destiny has long load times, but the thing with Destiny is, when you pick the mission or the roam area, whatever you're doing, and you pick it, it's a long load to get there, but once you've loaded and you're there, it's done. And, like, you get to do the entire thing you picked to do seamlessly, no loads. If, like, you're unlucky on, like, a strike and things are going weird and there are a bunch of bit different people, you might end up, while you're running into a new area, like, the screen freezes for a little bit and a little, like, progress bar comes up that says loading. That will happen once, like, every 20 hours playing Destiny, and it's, like, a weird freak occurrence that you're, like, and that would happen sometimes in Halo, where that would happen also sometimes. You're like, oh, this is really weird. Something weird happened with the streaming of data. So that's how the loading in Destiny works. And I kind of thought that's what people were talking about with the Anthem stuff.
And to be clear,
little did I know,
that's how the loading in most games work now. Like, Red Dead 2, Assassin's Creed, Zelda Breath of the Wild, Hitman. There are, sometimes it's one open world, sometimes it's like segmented open worlds. Dragon Age Inquisition had the segmented open world. But when you're in a segment, it never breaks with loading. Like Zelda, you only see loading when you're going to one of the shrines. Red Dead, you only see loading on fast travel. Like that's what we're accustomed to. And it's not even this generation, like that was most of the previous generation too. Like the whole notion of segmented open worlds that have to load in like an Ocarina of Time or something, that ended around the PS2, early PS3, right?
Yeah, yes, exactly. And so for Anthem, I ran into this bizarre situation where you're playing that first mission, and it takes you a while to figure out where the fuck you're supposed to go, but eventually you figure out that you're supposed to be going into this cave. And so you fly into this cave, and all of a sudden, You're just flying into what is a totally normal-looking cave. Looks the same as any other geometry in the world around you. You enter the cave, and smack cut to this fucking loading screen, and the game just sits there and loads for like 10 to 15 seconds, and you load into this cave. And if you're like me, you still haven't quite figured out what the fuck you're doing. And so you're just like, one, you're just like, what the fuck was the game crash? What is this load? Then you load into the cave, you fly around the cave for a little bit, have no idea what the fuck you're doing. Fly, like, end up, like, looking around for what you're supposed to do, end up going just far enough to the edge of the cave entrance that you end up loading out of the cave again, like, motherfucker, have to go, like, load out of the cave, fly back in, load back into the cave, then find the thing that is, like, the thing that you need to go look at to get the objective, but is a thing you can't do yet, because the objective is you look at this thing, and then you go kill a bunch of guys, and then you come back, and you have the thing to unlock the door. So it's like, I loaded in and out of that cave, I swear to God, like, 5 or 6 times in that mission, because it's the first time I played the game, and I had no idea what I was doing.
And lest you think, oh, is it just on caves? No, because that mission, you have to go to several other areas that require you to load. And again, like, cave sounds like, well, that's a transition. It's really not, but it sounds like it could be. There are areas where you're just, like, you're flying over an open area, load, you're in more of the open area. Like, that's how it works. It is straight up like Twilight Princess or something, like one of the earlier Kingdom Hearts games. Like, my brother pointed out that this is one of the big things in Kingdom Hearts 3, is that you're not loading in between areas the way Kingdom Hearts 1 and 2 did. Little did I know that piece of knowledge would kind of come in handy with Anthem, and I'm like, oh, that's what this reminds me of, is a PS2 game. And, like, on a PS...
Yeah, but it's even worse than that, because on those games, like, you know, like an old BioWare game, like a Knights of the Old Republic or a Mass Effect or something like that, like you would load into a chunk of a level and play through that area and then go into another chunk where you hit a loading screen. But that's always like you're walking through a door, or there's like a, or even if it's something weird where there's like, it's more of like an open worldy thing and you're like going from one area to the other, there's like a barrier, or there's a clear indicator, or there's something like, you know, in a Zelda game, it's that thing where like you're walking through and the camera, instead of following you, kind of locks at that angle and you see Link run into the distance into the next area, and then it's like a brief loading kind of thing. Like there's all these visual information tricks that games will use to indicate to you that you're about to hit a loading screen. Anthem doesn't use any of those. There's nothing.
It's always
like, you are literally... Yeah, it's always jarring. Even because when you say it's always jarring, that's not just saying like, oh, the first time you hit it, it's always jarring. It's always jarring every time you hit it. Even when I knew that there was a load at the entrance of that cave, it always surprised me because there's nothing indicating the exact point where you transition into the loading screen. There's no blue force field. There's no camera thing. You're not even flying into like fog or something to show that the area beyond here doesn't look loaded yet, like a fucking N64 game or something. It's just, you can see exactly where you're going. Like everywhere else, you just smack into a fucking load screen out of nowhere, and it feels cheap and gross and weird and archaic in a way I was not expecting. Like, it really threw me for a loop every time I hit one of those fucking loading screens.
I mean, I don't want to be, like, too hard on this on some level, but at the same time, like, it makes it borderline unplayable just because it so runs against our language for open world games. Like, this is, you know, Anthem is not doing anything new here. It is not creating a new genre of game. We understand how a game like this is played, and it doesn't feel like this. And it just, it feels so abjectly different to anything else you've played, that it's never not going to be jarring because there's nothing else to compare it to that plays like that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. This is the thing that freaks me out most, though. Where did the sound design go? Like, genuinely, is it stripped out for story reasons? Is it just not there? Like, in the tower, whatever their equivalent of the tower is, like, you load in, and it is just eerily silent. It like, you hear a couple of, like, little footsteps or something, but, like, there is no chatter, there is no noise, there is no music. It is very bizarre. You get out into the world, you can hide it a little bit more, but all you're hearing usually is combat noise, like how your gun is firing. If a grenade goes off, you hear that, but it doesn't really sound like there's environmental sounds. There's no atmospheric sounds. I did not hear music until I played the Stronghold, and I heard music there. So I don't know if this is a glitch, or if there just literally isn't sound design, or if they're holding it back for the demo, in which case that's the weirdest thing I've ever heard of for a demo. But it is, like, it's legitimately eerie, because this is another thing where it's like, I know how video games sound, and I know that they sound like sound, and there's no sound here. It's weird.
Yeah. So it's like, one is that, like, the music is incredibly sparse, but not in that, like, Red Dead Redemption 2 or Breath of the Wild way, where it's like, that's clearly, like, this artistic choice, and when the music comes in, it's very atmospheric and weird. It's not that. Like, when the music came in, like a little bit on a couple of missions, like I think mission 2 and 3, if I say a couple of missions, it was just like very generic. Like you could have told me that that was like music from Dragon Age.
Sounds like Destiny music in some cases.
Yeah. I mean, except for not like,
not like good, but like
felt like
the like big brass, like propulsive, like the drum kind of the percussive elements of it. Yeah.
Yeah, so it was like just felt like very generic video game music that I just, in person, because it was so sparse, I never got a sense of any sort of like thematic texture or anything to it. It just was like, okay, I guess there's music playing here. I wouldn't even have noticed this music playing right now if not for the fact that this is the literally, I think, the first time I've heard music in this game. So that was really weird. But the bigger issue than the music is that the sound design is just mostly absent. And one of the big ones of where like the sound design really is hurt is that the enemies make, like, almost no noise. And that's one of the things I was talking about with, like, the boss attacking me and me kind of having no idea what was going on, is the sound, like, it made a noise when it hit me, and it probably made a noise when it shot its gun, although maybe it didn't. But it just never, like, the sound design never popped to me in a way that, like, felt clear what was going on. Compare that, again, to Destiny, a game that has incredible fucking sound design. And just go back to the Destiny Alpha.
It's possible the first thing we ever commented on with Destiny is the sound design for the vehicles.
The Sparrow? Yeah, the Sparrow noises. But not even that, like, because that's just cool, like, texture sound design. But, like, sound design is not just for adding texture to the world. It's for communicating information to the player. Jonathan, I just want you to think right now, what does it sound like when you fight a spider tank in Destiny?
I can hear it. I can hear the sound effects. I can hear the as it like falls down and its thing opens up. I can hear the specific musical cues tied to that kind of tank. I can hear, I'm using a pulse rifle now. Oh, this is a scout rifle. Like I can just, it's all there.
Yeah, every single attack it uses, right? When it pops out little bouncing, like, shock balls. When it fires its, like, fast machine, like, plasma machine gun. When it, like, lowers down to fire, like, the big one that it shoots, the big, like, red targeting laser to fire the boom, giant explosive. All of those things have different sound effects to them that communicate extremely clearly to the player, whether you're looking at that fucking thing or you're, like, fighting a dreg on the other side of the map. You know exactly what the fuck that spider tank is doing 100% of the time you're fighting it. That was true the first time you fought it in the Destiny Alpha. It's true if you go and do fight one in a public event today in Destiny 2 Forsaken. Like, that is fucking sound design in a video game. It's not just adding texture. It's communicating to you information about what is going on in the game world around you. And, like, the spider tank is a great example because they're, like, very big, clear noises. Because it's a big, giant, like, damaging enemy. But all the enemies in Destiny do that. Like, the Hive Knight makes a different kind of noise than the Hive Wizard, whether it's, like, putting its shield up or it's attacking you, you know? All those things communicate information to the player in subtle ways that make it a very clear experience of what's going on around you and how you, in, like, if you're able to parse that information, you're able to use it to play the game effectively. in Anthem, it was just like nothing. Like, I have no idea. I don't know what kind of enemies I'm fighting. Nothing about like the personality of the enemies is communicated by any sort of sound design, but nothing about like the combat situations is being communicated to me by sound design, other than that I'm just going bup 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 bup, and that's it. Like, that's all the sound design is doing for me, and that's a huge issue in playing this game.
It's so bad, though, I kind of like feel like I need to put an asterisk by it, because I almost can't believe a major release would come out with sound like this. Like, because I've never encountered a video game where, like, there are literally chunks where it just sounds like there's just, it's, we're not saying it's bad, it's absent. And that's the difference. Like, I've heard games with bad sound design, it's not there in this game for big chunks. And I don't know if that's a choice they made for the demo. I don't know if it's the actual game. I don't know if it's a glitch, because this thing is pretty buggy in its current form. It's very confusing. I also, are other people commenting on this? Because I thought I was going insane trying to figure this out.
Yeah, it's not the first complaint that comes up, because the first complaint typically is like, I can't even load into this thing. This thing is fucking broken. But there are other people complaining about it, for sure. Yeah.
I mean, I guess as we start to wind down on this, I mean, the big question is, does this game feel like it's ready to come out of the oven next week?
God, no. Like, this game does not feel like it's a beta for a game that's about to come out. I mean, and I want to make it clear, I understand, like, this is not my first Sean Chapman's beta corner, right? I know that betas for games in demos, like, not specifically demos, like, more actually, like, betas, things that are pre-release material, that this is not the most current build of Anthem. There are lots of technical reasons of, like, they need a more stable build. So this is a build of Anthem that's probably about 2 months, maybe 3 months old at this point. That's how this kind of stuff always works. So it's like, I know that there's probably some issues with this that are already fixed in the build they have. Even taking that into account, this does not feel like a game that is ready for prime time. This is not, like, especially if you compare it to the Destiny Alpha, which was a much further off build than what this is. That felt like, okay, this is a game
that's polished
that,
as fuck. I mean,
yeah, that's polished. Like, the issues with the ultimate game of Destiny that then came out that September had nothing to do with the stuff in the alpha. It was 100% with, like, oh, like, the end game is really weird and there's not enough story content and the story content gets repetitive. But like, if you just, that one chunk that they had at the beginning, from the beginning of the game in that alpha was super solid. The combat was there. The loot like cycle was there. The classes were awesome. All that stuff, like the music and the presentation elements, all of it felt great. None of it feels great here. Another thing I want to address while I'm thinking about it before I forget is, like, I think this game has some design elements like the javelins that look pretty good, but overall I find like the visual aesthetic of this game incredibly bland, and there are sections where it just straight up looks bad to me, and like textures look rough, like the foliage, like the lighting is very dull, and so like the foliage just like looks just like it, like it, I, it doesn't, like, I obviously, if I put like these screenshots side to side, they wouldn't look like this, but it feels like it looks like an Xbox 360 or PS3 game in moments to me, just in terms of the lighting and the foliage and the like look of the game just feels blah. Like, it just doesn't have a unique visual identity in most instances, and that's another area where it is like a far cry from something like a Destiny that has a very striking, powerful, effective art style. Anthem, I think, technically is probably fine. It's just like the art style and everything about the aesthetic it goes for, I find like mildly interesting to very bland.
Well, the frame rate's all over the map, so that's a problem. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I think the visual like fidelity is fine. I agree, the art direction, like, there's, it's the blandest looking BioWare game I've ever seen. And you know, I hate that we have to make so many Destiny comparisons, but it's not really our choice. This is a situation where it's like, you know, to quote The Wire, you come at the king, you best not miss. They came at the king. They invited the comparisons because, you know, like, they had talked a big game about how, like, no, this is what BioWare wanted to make this whole generation, and this is what they were aiming for. It's like, well, no, because before this generation, there was no Destiny, and this is a Destiny clone. Like, this is not, you cannot write this off as, like, Anthem would exist in this form in a world with no Destiny, right? Like, not, some of these ideas exist in the ether, not all of them, and not in this arrangement. So I don't get it. It reminds me an awful lot of Mass Effect Andromeda, what I played of that, in terms of how it feels. unfinished, and its visual fidelity is all over the map, and its sound design is all over the map, and its story is either non-existent or bad, and its gameplay is just a weird hodgepodge that isn't fun to interact with. I'm really worried about, like, this game, what it will do to BioWare. I have no idea why anyone playing this demo would want to then go pay $60 for the game. It's kind of baffling mm-hmm. to me. At the same time, I don't feel like... I wonder if critics are going to hold this game's feet to the fire the way they did with Destiny 5 years ago. Because Destiny got savaged in ways that you and I continue to think was unwarranted at the time. Like, there yeah. were legitimate criticisms, but, like, you know... people went way too far with it for what Destiny is. I feel like this one, I'm having trouble gauging the critical reaction, and I think that's because everyone is having trouble figuring out what this game is. I mean, it's possible, like, if it launches with the same connectivity issues it's been having, that's going to be crazy, because it needs yeah. to work on day one. Destiny worked on day one, and it always has. Like, you know, it's an online game, it just needs to. So I'm really curious about what winds up with this, but it is not a good-looking situation.
Yeah, just to quickly wrap up another couple of things, because since it is technically a BioWare game, we at least have to address story.
There's nothing
character.
In here.
Yeah, there's almost like the whole story of the demo is there's a character named Matthias, I think, who you find a thing called the Manifold that splits him into three personalities, and it's basic. And then at the end of the story, he's still three personalities because they're like, yeah, fuck it. And I guess that's... I assume he's going to continue to be a character in the story in the launching game.
He's the only character you have. He's bland as fuck. The dialogue doesn't sound... or like that's the biggest thing here, Sean, in terms of presentation, is there's nothing about this game that feels like BioWare to me. This could have been anybody. Mm-hmm. There's no distinguishing characteristic. You booted up Destiny, that was a Bungie game. It just... It always was, very clearly. There's nothing about...
You took one glance at those fucking skyboxes, it's like, I'm in Bungie town, yep. man. Look at those skyboxes, they are gorgeous.
And BioWare is, like, you know, it's one of the bees. It's BioWare, it's Blizzard, it's Bungie. Like, all these companies that are so identifiable... And this doesn't feel even remotely like BioWare to me at all.
Yeah. I mean, all the dialogue from your character, the freelancer, feels like it's like the little bit I saw of Mass Effect Andromeda. It's the same shit. Like, they just went to this, like, bad, like, Han Solo ripoff kind of like, hey, I'm a smarmy fucking, like, dude who's out for himself. And like that's just the tone of every fucking line of dialogue your dude says, and it's just the weakest shit. It reminds me of when people were like so impressed with the fucking Ezio in Assassin's Creed 2, which I like Assassin's Creed 2, but people always went to this like, Ezio is such a good character. It's like, no, he was roguish, like, and that was his character trait. And I think, like, it was easy to be impressed with roguish in video games in like 2007 or something for some people, but not in any game in 2019 can you just be roguish and that's your whole thing. It's like, I'm a charming rogue. Oh, that's my whole shtick. And that feels like exactly what they tried to do with the main character Mass Effect Andromeda. That feels exactly what they're trying to do with this fucking character, and it fucking sucks.
It does. Anything else with Anthem?
I had to feel like I was going to say something else. We talked about the frame rates fucking all over the place. All the first-person controls in the city...
That's weird.
Terrible. Like, if you want a fucking just, like, culture shock effect, go from playing Destiny to the first-person controls in that city where you're moving at this sluggish pace and just, it's just this, like, just super grit. Like, moving it around, the cursor around, feels gross. This game handles inverted controls in a really weird way, which is something that only affects me on this podcast. But there are four different options for, like, situations in which you want the controls inverted. One of which I was very confused of, like, for flight controls. I didn't know what was inverted and what was not for flight controls, because I would say that what most people call inverted is what is normal for flight controls, but no, it's default whatever. But the thing, but what's really annoying is when you're talking to someone in the city, no matter what your controls are, if you're trying to manipulate the camera in that instance, it's just default. And so if you're like looking in first person and talking to a dude, you can kind of move the camera around a little bit, but it defaults to default in that instance. And there's, as far as I know, no way to make that inverted. And that just feels weird. And if you're someone who's like, I don't play inverted, just in, like, as an empathy exercise, imagine for you if it was the opposite, and in every other situation of that game, it was normal default controls for you, but for whatever reason, when you're talking to someone in first person, now you have to pull the stick back to look up, and you're like, what the fuck is this?
It would be very weird.
Yes, and so it's just like, and that's the kind of thing that maybe that's the thing to leave the end on, is just Anthem feels like a sloppy fucking thing that is going to be out in like a week or two. And it's just slopping out there. And you normally, one would expect much more from BioWare. But this generation, Dragon Age Inquisition was a pretty good game that had a lot of issues. Mass Effect Andromeda, it seems like it was a not good game that had way more issues. And Anthem seems like it's probably better than Mass Effect Andromeda. But
I would not say that after this, no.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's going to be a dedicated audience of this game that finds the depth to the combat system that I suspect is there in the end game. And I think there will be an audience, a niche audience, that will really like this game. But I think the mainstream audience will be so put off by the terrible presentation stuff, at the very least, and what I suspect is going to be a long on-ramp to get to the fun stuff in the combat at the end of the game, that I'm not going to play it.
No.
And I think most people, even if they do pick it up because it's a big BioWare game that's getting a lot of marketing from EA, probably, I suspect it must have, I don't know. I feel like I'm so out of like where people market stuff at this point. I don't know what gets marketing. EA is probably getting to this game a big marketing push. People will buy it. I think people will be very dissatisfied. And it makes me concerned for the future of BioWare.
Yeah, I'm worried this is it. Like, I think, I don't think this is going to be a hit. I really don't see the world where that's going to happen. In a world where Destiny wasn't doing enough for Activision, I don't see any world where this is doing enough for EA. I think best case scenario is BioWare gets some sort of buyout deal where they're able to be independent and they're able to, like, do some sort of passion project. But that's not how EA plays things. I think BioWare is a past tense thing. Like, I think Mass Effect 3 and Dragon Age Inquisition were it. And I'd love to be proven wrong, but I don't see the world where that's not the case. Because this is such a... This game feels like such a crass, corporate, what's popular right now, what do we make? It does not feel like something from the heart. Which Destiny, for all its flaws, always was, clearly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was a hot...
And this also just feels like a game that needs to bake for, like, at least another year.
Yeah, the least. Jesus, yeah. All right, that's Anthem. Hopefully that's not it for BioWare, but, you know, we'll see.
Yeah.
All right.
Super curious about what the reviews for that game are going to be.
Yeah.
And I guess we'll find out soon enough.
All right. Well, next week on the show, we'll talk about stuff. I'm not promising Lord of the Rings. You're not promising Lord of the Rings, but we'll see.
I'm not promising... I will promise that I will make an effort, but I cannot promise that effort will prove fruitful because I have a lot of stuff that I need to do.
I email that exact sentence to my teachers every Monday, just about just general things and responsibilities I have. They generally don't take it that well, but, you know, I try.
Yes, well, I think we can all look forward to the next episode of the Weekly Stuff podcast, where at the very least, I can definitely promise we will talk about stuff.